Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's a special Jack Vassell Memorial Fund episode of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. In this special episode, Cody and John have broken out of the gaming podcaster's retirement home to bring you one more fabulous foray into the abyss of gaming goodness in support of the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund. And now, live from the recently foreclosed Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, but surrounded by stacks and stacks of internet dollars, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We are a podcast...
We were a podcast. We're back from the dead.
About all types of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, role-playing games, and the like. It's been a great 8 months of gaming here in the
gaming
capital.
Retirement has been great.
It's been wonderful. But we're back for one night only.
For one night only.
That's right.
For charity.
For charity, for the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund. Cody, do you want to mention a little bit about how this is going to work?
So the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund, they do an auction. People put up games. People put up, you know, various services. I know Dave Briel, one of the guys in our gaming group, last year he put up shuttle service to and from the Indy airport from Gen Con, because like us, he lives in Indy.
Oh.
And I think like some Days of Wonder guys bought it.
Really?
Yeah. So Dave picked him up at the airport, you know, took him to their hotel, and then took him back to the airport at the end of the con.
Nice.
So that was a brilliant idea. I'm like, well, I don't want to drive to the airport, so what can we do? We decided to put up, because a few people listen to the show, we decided we would do one more episode for the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund to raise some money for that great cause. So you got to listen to us. And it's on the Dice Tower feed.
That's right.
So if you've never heard of us, I'm sorry.
The Big Daddy. You just got to suffer through this. Sorry, we're some other podcast that used to exist. And
yeah. Our star has faded, but hopefully it's not a terrible hour plus of enjoyment.
Right. Don't go to gameonpodcast.com because we're not there anymore.
Yeah. It's some spam site, I think, has picked it up. So.
Something, yeah.
America.
Well, we have a lot of stuff to talk about. We basically, as part of this auction, is the winner of our auction, who we're going to talk about in just a little bit here. He was able to pick out, was it three things?
Yeah,
for our show?
So he got to pick out the big deal topic. Mm-hmm. He got to pick out a GM Academy topic, and what game we review for Biochar and I. And I'm thankful he didn't, you know, go with like Magic Realm or like Loop and Louie or something that would be really hard to get a hold of.
I thought that's what was going to happen.
I did too.
I really did.
I was kind of worried, but he went.
World in flames.
Exactly. He went. He went pretty nice. We got Android Netrunner.
Yep.
It was the new hotness. I'd say it's still.
Oh, absolutely.
It's still burning bright.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll talk about
it. You bought it, so that's a good indicator.
I did. That was nice. So yeah, we're going to talk about Android Netrunner and our Buy, Try, or Deny. Our big deal topic is going to be about Gen Con, which we know a couple things about.
That's right.
And our GM Academy, we'll be talking a little bit about how to get an RPG group started. So lots to talk about. And, you know, for those of you who have listened to our show in the past, we're happy to be back for one time only here, and hope you will enjoy.
We're
this
not
show.
Coming back full time.
No, we're
I'm
not.
Sorry.
This is not like, oh, they got the itch and they came back. No, we're just for this one time. So we hope you enjoy it
for the kids.
But as always, we're going to start off with a rundown. So let's do it
now.
Well, it's time for the rundown, where we're going to talk about all of the games and geekery we participated in for the last 8 months.
We'll hit the highlights.
Not everything we played.
And then on May 6th, I played some Eclipse, it was very enjoyable.
Very exciting. But before we do, we always, as always, need to pay due penance to our great sponsor. Oh, but wait.
No, we do have a sponsor.
We do have a sponsor, but it's not our previous sponsor.
We still like Myriad Games. You should still go there.
They're great.
They're great. MyriadGames.com. But the guy who paid for this episode, and we are catering to his whims, is one Mr. Trent Ham.
All right, let's give a little clap for
well done.
Trent. Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your contribution to the fund, as it were. He is from beautiful, beautiful Huxley, Iowa.
Huxley, Iowa.
It's a suburb of Des Moines.
I was on the list of states I haven't been to.
It's nice. I mean, it's Indiana with maybe a little more elevation.
Are they corn or are they wheat?
Oh, they're corn.
They're corn? Okay.
I mean, it's all the same to me, really. But anyway.
Is Huxley near River City?
No. I mean, they got some trouble
there.
That's what
I hear, yeah.
Yeah. So, and his favorite game is Android Netrunner, which he wanted us to do Buy, Try, or Deny. So we will just thoroughly trash that when we get to it. Like we mentioned, it's topic for the big deal. We'll be doing not just a Gen Con episode, but if Gen Con 2013 is the first convention, first Gen Con you're going to.
Yeah.
So basically kind of our Gen Con thing, but a little early.
You know, I feel like if nothing else, as we have faded into the sunset of podcasting, we still are kind of gaming ambassadors for Indianapolis.
Oh, sure.
You know, so when Gen Con comes around, I sort of get that itch, like, you know, I'll guest star on the podcast to be mm-hmm. that snobby Indianapolis guy.
Hoosier Hospitality. We are nice folks.
Speaking of Indianapolis,
yeah.
Do you have more on Trent?
No. Okay. We'll get to Trent. We'll get to his stuff as we go along.
But yes, thanks. We'll mention it several times. Thanks so much to Trent for sponsoring and making this episode possible.
Mm-hmm.
We always used to talk about at the very beginning of our show. Whatever happened with the Colts?
We did,
and a lot has happened since we left. and I just want to say, Andrew Luck might be the real deal.
My goodness! I mean, we just yesterday was the thrilling comeback over the Lions.
Yeah,
that was fantastic. And you know, I said before the season started, if we went 4-12, that would be a good first year, because I think Peyton Manning's first season was like
three and thirteen, I think.
Yeah, 2-14 or 3-13 or something like that. Yeah. And Andrew Luck's been just a stud, and you know,
we're now guaranteed to at least have a break even season.
We are.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, our track record of dopey looking white guys drafted number one at quarterback,
going pretty well.
2-for-2 right now.
Yeah, all right. So there's your Colts tidbit for the.
The one guy is yelling at his computer, stop talking about the Colts.
This is why I stopped listening to this show. Anyway, okay, so now that we've given due penance to our sponsor, Trent, let's go with the rundown. You want to start?
Sure. So I'm just going to hit some of the highlights.
Go for it.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
We did we used to travel to New Hampshire to do the Extra Life 24-Hour Gaming Marathon.
Live Free or Die?
Live Free or Die, indeed. I almost forgot. See, mm-hmm. Look at me. Look, I would have died there
because
I wasn't living free. we decided, now that we've got the Game On Game groups really been cooking here, so we decided to do a 24-hour game day here. And so I'm going to give you some of the highlights on that, because I thought that was pretty neat. We did. It's a nice gaming session when you can get in both a game of Through the Ages and Twilight Imperium in one. Technically, one game day.
That's
granted. It was probably about half the game day, but
yeah. How many total games did you play at Extra Life this year?
I only played probably 9 or 10 because I played a lot.
No, that's pretty good though, given the two of them.
Sure, yeah. I mean, but it's pretty much I played those two and a lot of short games.
Okay,
you know, but you know, we played Twilight Imperium, which John won.
I did
that. What? That doesn't happen.
That was great.
Yeah.
It was only my second full game of it.
Yeah.
And we played kind of a half game one time. But,
yeah.
Oh, man, I really like that game.
It's a solid game.
Gosh, I found myself thinking about it for days afterwards.
That's the TI effect. It's like, you know, there's a meetup group here in Indy. I go every once in a while. You know, they play a lot. I really like Twilight Imperium, but it's one of those, I can't play it every week.
Yeah.
You know, sorry, mm-hmm. I've got other things to do. But it's one of those where you're just thinking about it. It tells such a narrative, and it's just, you know, such an experience.
Yeah.
And you know, I thought we did, you know, not counting rules explanation, we had 6 players. We had at least one or two first timers.
Yeah.
I think we had two first timers.
Two first timers.
We wrapped up in 6 hours.
Yeah.
And we started what, like 9 p.m. 10
yep,
p.m.
Got done. We started at 9 and okay. got done right at 3.
Yeah.
3 a.m.
And the thing is, you know, whenever I talk about Twilight Imperium, people are like, just how can you sit at one game for 6 hours? It doesn't feel like it.
It really doesn't.
Because it's just one of those things where, you know, part of it is you're enjoying yourself, but part of it is you do your action, and then other people are doing theirs, and you can check out a little bit. Like, you know, obviously you want to pay attention to what they're doing,
yeah.
but, you know, your brain doesn't have to be on the whole time.
If you're playing, quote unquote, correctly,
mm-hmm.
you know, when other people are doing things, you should be planning out your move
as
to what you're going to do. And then, so then you could step away. I did this several times, step away from the table to go talk to some people or everything. And when they call back to the table, John, it's your turn. You come back, you know what you're going to do. You take your action, do what you're going to do. And then but I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really like that game. If we were to do a top 11, which we're not going to, I think that one is bumped up in somewhere into the top 11
nice.
For me, because it's, man, really good game.
It's a solid game. And I always get the itch to buy it, but But I really think, I know this was, I've done predictions on this, and I've been wrong years and years and years. I really think they're going to do a fourth edition soon, especially now that they're taking all their Coffin Box games and just putting them into deep games. Yeah. And like Rune Wars did it, and what am I thinking of?
Well, Mansions of Madness already was like that.
Yeah, well, Descent. I mean, Descent had a new edition.
Yeah, but the same thing. They went to some of the deep box there.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, we didn't really get to talk about Descent. That came on after we...
That's on my list.
Okay, so we'll talk about it then. Because I figured that was kind of one of our big things back in the day. You know? So we'll talk about that. Other game, I got to play Transamerica for the first time.
Oh.
Which, it's a train game that's easier than Ticket to Ride.
Really?
Kind of boring.
Really?
Yeah, I mean,
I heard good things about it being the gateway potential.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
for
a good
one.
Gateway game, but man, it's just, yeah. If you think Ticket to Ride kind of has a pasted on thing, this really has a pasted on thing.
See, now my favorite game at not my favorite game, but one of my favorite games at Extra Life was this party game called Snake Oil.
Yes,
and that was good. Then we played that at 5-6 in the morning or something like that. We'd been up for a long time, but. It's a really cool game because it's kind of got the apple to apples feel, you know, where you're a judge and you get to pick the best of a particular set of things. And what it is that everybody has two cards. Everybody has a whole hand of cards, but the person who's the judge will turn over a card that says what they are in some kind of role, like a cheerleader or a newlywed or a firefighter or something like that. And then you have to take two of the cards that are in your hand, and these are cards that have nouns and adjectives and things like that on them. You have to put two of them together to make a product that you then have to pitch to the person, you know, who's the judge, and you go around the table each pitching these different items, and then the person picks their favorite. The scoring, I mean, it doesn't really matter that much. It's mainly just one of those games where it's fun and people laugh. But maybe it was because of the fact that it was five or six in the morning and everybody was kind of tired anyway. But I thought it was a whole lot of fun. And it really kind of highlights to me how in America we are so used to being marketed to that we sat in this particular game. I think we had six or seven people, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was a wide range. It was both genders, and it was a wide range of ages and a wide variety of people. And everybody pretty much knew how to do this, you know, Cody, you're a newlywed, and it's hard for a newlywed. Everything started off with, you know, it's really hard when you're
newlywed. Yeah, empathize.
You know, when you're a firefighter, it's hard, and you know, and you really need.
When you're a millionaire, it's tough.
It's tough when you're a millionaire, and so it was just a lot of fun. And our friend of the show, Keith Collins,
I
think he won, and he knocked it out of the park every single time. It was really, really fun.
I wish I could remember some of the things we were coming up with, but
my favorite for you, it was for like a caveman or something, and you came up with the revenge elephant.
Yes. Yeah, revenge elephant.
That was great. I mean, anyway,
if you're gonna have an elephant, a revenge elephant. Exactly. But you know what? One other, we played so many games, but probably the highlight of the Extra Life thing was the Star Trek: The Next Generation interactive VCR game, which
circa 1992, something like that,
thereabouts. Yeah. And you know, I saw it on Board Game Geek one time, and I was like, well, I gotta have this. You know, this is fantastic. So I found it was like $10 on eBay. And someone online had taken the original video, and now I've got it on my iPad, but I still had the tape. And since we play in kind of like a church youth group area, there was a TV with a VCR.
What church youth group is not going to have a TV with a VCR strapped
in? So what time did we play? 3 in the morning?
It was right after the TI3, so it was like 3:30 in the morning.
Okay. So yeah, we got everyone together and played this. I'd never played an interactive VCR game. It was pretty terrible. But I mean, there's like communicator stickers and rank pips and you have to interact with a TV. Basically the deep storyline is that a Klingon, Kavok, he takes control of the Enterprise when it's in space dock, and there's no one on the ship except you, the players. You're like the night janitors or whatever. And the Klingon is played by Robert O'Reilly, who played Chancellor Gowron. If you know Star Trek, you know he's the quintessential Klingon, right? He's kind of crazy eyes, but in this he's just Kavok, and he taunts you. It's basically kind of a semi. It's kind of a cooperative game, I guess. It's a terrible just roll and move. You're trying to collect isolinear chips and get to the bridge and stop Kavok.
Made worse by the fact that you're being given orders by a Klingon who's standing on the bridge of the Enterprise. And the story for why he's doing that is kind of
weak. No. Because he's taking the Enterprise to... He's taking it to Kronos to fight the other Klingons and start a war between the Federation and...
It surely wasn't because they couldn't get an actual Federation member of the cast to participate in this game.
Exactly. I mean, Jonathan Frakes did a voiceover.
Frakes did do a voiceover,
so he got some cash.
That would have been better if it was Riker, though.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have been able to yell at you like the Klingons do.
Yeah, I mean, so... And it's this crazy thing. He comes on screen and he yells at certain people. He gives people nicknames.
Usually, not to give any spoilers here, because I know you guys are going to rush out and buy it, but he'll just say, "You, the one who is moving now."
Experience beige.
Oh, man.
The Klingon word for pain. It's a terrible game, but man, at 3:34 in the morning, it was the perfect game in a lot of ways. So,
and after a big victory in TI3, who won the interactive VCR game? John won the game.
What was your rank?
Was I lieutenant? I think I might have been. Lieutenant.
I blocked part of it out, but
yeah.
So there's going to be, right now it's a seller's market but after people hear this, it's those copies are going to be snatched up. So get that Star Trek interactive VCR game, a Klingon challenge. I like how they named it. There was never a second one.
Right.
I've got a limited edition one. It has a number.
I want to see Fantasy Flight put out the reprint of that.
$80 version, absolutely.
Interactive iPad digital game.
Little Cory cards in it. It'd be fantastic.
Oh, man.
I played a lot of stuff, but those have been some highlights. John, what have you been playing?
Well, in addition to all the Extra Life stuff, had a lot of games that have just sort of come to the house and that I've purchased through Myriad Games, most of them actually. But been trying to focus on a lot of things to play with the family, because my son is reaching that magical, I think I've said it before, he reached that magical age. He's 9 years old. He's 9 and a half now. And he can learn most games, I think. There's still some of the more complex ones that he'd have trouble with. But I taught him Ticket to Ride for the first time, and he just flew through that.
That'd be no problem.
Oh, it's easy for him now. I wanted to pick up, because my kids have enjoyed Descent, which we'll talk a little bit more about Descent in a second, but they've enjoyed Descent and the new edition of Descent. I wanted to pick up Mice and Mystics from Plaid Hat Games, which has gotten a lot of buzz lately. So I got that one in, had a chance to play it about a week ago, and it is really, really, really good. It's really good for the family. If you're sitting around with a group of gamers, it's probably still going to be okay, I guess, because it's a dungeon crawl. But the mechanics are pretty simple, and it's so story-driven. When certain things happen, you're supposed to stop and open up the book and read this paragraph of story. And so for me, because I'm used to reading stories to my kids at night, it was very cool to, you just opened that door. Okay, hold on a second, Ethan. And I would grab the book and we'd read the story and I'd do some voices and everything. And so that was a very fun family sort of thing. If you were in a group of gamers doing that, you might choose to skip it,
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever, unless you're a big RP kind of group that's going to, sit and do the that kind of stuff. But as a game itself, it's very, very solid. The components are great. The miniatures are nice. And it's way more than just kill the monsters. Matter of fact, really killing the monsters, which in this game are like rats and cockroaches and bugs and things like that, that's really not the point at all. You have some sort of a mission of things, something that you're trying to get to. And it's really cool.
I think Plaid Hat, in conjunction with maybe the Jack Vassil Memorial Fund, you can download the...
audio files for that were based, and it's a
Rich Sommer,
Hollywood actor and gamer Rich Sommer from the television show Mad Men. He went into a studio and recorded all of the stories, like 53 audio files from the book that comes with the game. And so if you didn't want to read the story yourself or feel silly or whatever, you could buy those. And I think it's $9.95 from Plaid Hat Games website. All the money goes to the Jack Vassil Memorial Fund, and you can play those and have Rich Sommer's lilting voice.
The only downside is he does them all as Harry Crane. So he's pitching them as TV shows, and he's just kind of sleazy the whole time.
It's just
so,
right.
I mean,
right.
It's $10. What are you doing?
You can like see you can hear the smoke
that's
coming
right
off his pipe there, or cigarette. Man. Anyway, so that's a really, really good game. I've enjoyed that one with the kids. I've been playing an awful lot of the X-Wing miniatures game.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely bought into that at Gen Con.
I
take it back. I don't think did I buy it at Gen Con? I can't remember now.
I think you did.
I think I bought the starter. Yeah, by that time they were out of all of the expansions. But then I ended up buying a bunch of the expansions and another starter. Cody did not like it.
No.
But we just played we just played with the starter, right? We just played.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have since, my son and I just played last week with He played the Rebels with three X-Wings and a Y-Wing. Yeah, I think that was it. And then I played with like a TIE Advanced and six TIE Fighters. That's a pretty cool game, especially when you use the scenarios that come with it. Any game that's like that, that's just kill all the opponent's ships, that becomes a little boring, I think, after a while. But they had some pretty decent scenarios that came with the base game, and I think the one we had to play was the Imperial forces had to go and scan these satellites that represented, you know, rebel information or something like that, or encrypted communications.
Recipes.
Yeah, exactly. And so you had to basically get your ships on top of those and then do a scanning action instead of doing an attack, and then get at least one of your ships back off your side of the board. And then the rebels were supposed to kill everybody. And that made it a lot of fun.
I'd give it another go.
You should. Yeah. It's a solid game. So I've been playing a whole lot of that one. Let's see, what are some other things? I think we might have talked to earlier in the year about this little game called Timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we didn't, then it's definitely something I've been talking about a lot. And it's a little card game where you're placing things in chronological order. Every card has some sort of an event or an invention or something like that on one side. And on the other side, it has the year that it happened or was invented or discovered. And everybody gets a few cards in front of them. You turn one card over to start your timeline. And then on your turn, you just take and put the card down in the middle and sort of say, where does it fit in the timeline? You turn it over. If you're correct, then it stays in the timeline and you've gotten rid of a card. And if not, then you discard it and draw another one. And the first player to get rid of their cards is the winner. And there's been three sets that have been released now. It's Inventions, Discoveries, and Historical Events. And I was hesitant to do it, but I finally, the other night, took all the cards and smushed them all together, yes, just put them into one giant deck,
nice,
and played like a 5 or 6 player game of it. And it's really, really fun. You wouldn't think there'd be much replayability because, you know, once I know those cards, then, you know, we wouldn't be able to replay it. It's really hard to remember all those things. And there's so many cards in the sets, especially if you get all three sets. Other than the ones that you would automatically know, like, you know, the year the guy landed on the moon. I mean, you know, things like that.
The guy.
The Neil Armstrong guy.
The guy.
R.I.P. But
Too soon, man.
Or the year that World War I ended or something like that. Most of these things you're not going to remember that easily. So highly recommend Timeline.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other things? Well, our friend on the Dice Tower, Eric Summerer, has been very, very excited all year about the release of the new edition of Merchant of Venus from Fantasy Flight. I think someone in conjunction with Stronghold Games, there was a hand in it somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I picked up a copy of this game because I had played the mocked up version that that Eric had put together, just the sort of the print and play version. And I liked it, and I wanted to see what this new version had to offer. And Cody, you played with me the first time, and our buddy Sam as well, using the what they call the standard game, which is the Fantasy Flight.
The new rules.
New rules. And I really liked it. You were not quite as hyped about it. It was
okay. It was not bad. Maybe I'd prefer the classic version. I don't know, but I don't know. It was just okay. I mean, there's kind of a lot going on. I think it's one of those where if I played it again, you know, I think I would I'd enjoy it a little more. But it's okay.
Feels like it's hard to develop a strategy.
Yeah,
because there's just so many variables and the way that your ship moves. It's kind of a roll and move game, but there's some ways you can sort of define where you're going to go and how many spaces you're going to go, but it's really hard sometimes to get where you want to go.
Yeah, it a lot of it seemed a little muddled, you know, like it was just kind of stuff in the way that didn't need to be there. But, you know, being a Merchant of Venus is hard.
It is hard.
And I don't know what you need for that. But it's okay. I would definitely play it again. I'd like to play the classic version. But from what I've heard both from you and from a lot of people is that the best version would be some hybrid of the classic and the Fantasy Flight version.
Yeah, because I got to play the classic version a few days after we played our standard game. And it's noticeably different. I mean, there's whole sets of components that are different. So Fantasy Flight really did do an upgrade and a change to a lot of the rules. But the basics are still there. It's still the same, sort of the same idea, except that one main huge difference is that in the standard game, the new Fantasy Flight game, it's 30 turns. That's the whole game. It's 30 turns, then you count up your money and you're done. Whereas in the classic game, it's a race to a particular amount of money. I think the standard game is the first person to 2,000 space bucks. And we ended up playing a shorter game, I think to either 1,000 or 1,500, something like that. I don't like that so much because I just sort of feel like you can look at what other people are doing, and every turn, if you know that someone's in the lead, you're like, did you win this time? No? Okay, well, I guess we'll keep going. You know? I don't know. Something to me about just...
That's almost kind of a hallmark of older game design, though.
Yeah. You know. I think you're right. But having the 30 turns and then... Especially since there's some sort of convoluted ways of getting points and money in this game, in the newer game, you don't really know who's winning. And I like that. I like being able to like add it all up and, sure. You know, you sort of have an idea, but you're not really sure. So, you know, but there's a few elements, including like the demand tokens. That was a huge thing in the classic game where it makes certain locations more attractive to go to drop things off at. And, those don't exist in the new game, although there's an option to add them. So I want to play it a few more times. I've already bought the Plano boxes to sort out all the cardboard tokens. There's tons of them. And so I'm going to give it a few more plays. Of course, I've already bought the game, but I think it's one to... The components are beautiful. It's a beautiful game. And you just need to play it a few more times. I played a few more other things, but I don't want to drone on for too long.
We both like the new Descent.
We did both like the new Descent. What are your thoughts on that as compared to the first Descent?
I think it fills the niche that they were trying to fill. I don't think they wanted to do 4-hour sessions of it. You know, they wanted these little bite sized, very palatable like adventures you could do, and you could do as many as you want. But campaign play out of the box, streamlined rules. I think they did a really good job.
Yeah.
I don't know if I need to have it. You know, because like I said, it's kind of my argument with the first Descent. I play role-playing games enough to, you know, fancy role-playing games enough to where I don't know if I need it.
Yeah.
But it's well done. You know, someone who really doesn't have the time for fancy RPGs or doesn't want to do that, you know, they want a more structured feel. I think Descent is really well done.
Yeah, and I bought a copy of that one, and I still have Castle Ravenloft from that the D&D adventure system from Wizards.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to let that one go now. I think it is Jones theoried out.
And it's a theory. It's not a rule.
It's a theory.
I don't care.
Let's pause for a second. In this special episode.
Sure.
To talk for just a second about the Jones theory. Because of all the things that have come out of our little podcast here over the last 3.5 years, the Jones theory is definitely something that we continue to hear over and over
again. I know.
Both in threads and in other podcasts. Because I'm a podcast fan as well as a former podcaster. And we just want to say that it's a theory, and here's why it's a theory and not a rule, okay?
Go for it.
Here's why.
Defend my honor, John.
Okay, because I understand people saying that it's the Jones rule. Now, for those of you who are who are listening to the Dice Tower Field again saying, who are these guys? The Jones theory was an idea that Cody came up with sort of midway through our podcast that says that in an effort to play more games and get more games that you like to the table, and to not really be a collector, mm-hmm. You know, to be a game player, not a collector, that you should never own more than one game that scratches a particular itch or fits a particular what we call bucket.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Unless, and this is the part people always forget.
Yes.
Is that unless you're getting to the table. So, if you really like train games, you can have Empire Builder and Ticket to Ride and Age of Steam.
That's not a train game. That's a set collection game.
Shut up. You can, as long as you're getting to the table, you can have 800 games in your collection if they're getting to the table enough for you to justify the cost and the space in your home, then that's fine. Yes. It's like every time, I don't even really look for my BGG, but they come up and...
That bastard's telling me that I can only have one train game.
Yeah, it's like, but who does he love think train games.
I love train games. I'm not going to follow that. That's crap. That's not what he's saying. It's not what he ever said. So, and the reason why it's a theory, not a rule, is because... This is Cody's theory about the best way to have a game collection slash, you know, the best way
to own
games. No, of course not. You rarely are. But
it's true. But yeah, I did not think it would catch on as it has. I mean,
I love it though because it has gotten people thinking about games and about their collections and about, you know, and I've heard on some other podcasts people talking about how, well, I'm just not going to subscribe to that because I'm a collector, mm-hmm. and I don't mind having 15 copies of the same kind of game because I just like to have them on the shelf and I like to look at them or whatever. You know, they're deriving enjoyment from something other than playing the games.
Cool.
Whereas really we both, I think, even though I have a bigger collection than Cody does, is, you know, we really derive our enjoyment from playing the games, mm-hmm. from having them on the table and playing them, not from just having them, having the pieces and the books and looking at them.
Right.
So that's where it's coming from. We would consider this the final word on the Jones Theory.
Oh, wow. That's bold.
QED. So, any other geekery, any books or TV shows, movies, stuff that you've been, comic books that you've been participating in?
I'm still into comics. Still kind of the same. I didn't know how long the comics thing would last, but I think it's going to stay. I've kind of found the five or six titles that I like.
We just went and got your comic pull tonight before we recorded.
The new James Bond movie was pretty slick.
Was it?
Very good.
I have to go check that one out.
Probably one of the better Bond movies I've seen.
I haven't seen any of the ones with Daniel Craig though.
So see Casino Royale. It's pretty good. You can skip Quantum of Solace. It's just kind of violent and oversexed. I don't know. I mean, it's even for a James Bond movie, it's not very good. But Skyfall is fantastic.
Nice.
Really good stuff.
Now, I don't know if there's a spoiler or something because I don't know anything about it, but is Skyfall the name of a name of something or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's all I'll say. Yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
Ooh, tricky. Okay. Anything else? I've not read any more in Dresden.
Okay.
I need to. I enjoyed the ones I read. I've been doing some literary junk food. I've been reading like the Star Trek The Next Generation like novels, the ones set after Nemesis, after the movies.
Oh, okay. Huh?
And, you know, so it's kind of because I read Deep Space Nine. They basically did their eighth season as books and they released this like big book series and I read it. It was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of bring, you know, what was The Next Generation folks doing at that time? And then it kind of continues the Trek thing. I mean, I call it literary junk food because it's doesn't take a lot of brain power to read and it's enjoyable and you know,
yeah
it's not tough. So
Peter David, he was my favorite Next Generation writer.
Yeah, he
wrote a few good things.
He's written some books, but I've never, they're called the new Star Trek New Frontier books, but I've never read them because all of the guys, they have Starfleet guys on the cover, but they always have a sword.
Oh,
and then I'm like, this is dumb.
Why do you have a sword?
Why do they have a sword? But yes, Peter David, solid guy.
Yeah.
No, that's probably it on the geekery front.
Okay.
I mean, there's probably been a lot going on, but yeah. we don't want to bore the people.
No, that's true. Well, I've been reading a lot of audiobooks or listening to a lot of audiobooks via my public library,
mm-hmm.
not audible.com. So, I mean,
that's right.
It's great. Audible's great and everything, but it does cost money and the library doesn't.
Support
your local library. So I listened to the entire Codex Alera series. I can't remember I think I had talked about that a little bit in the latter days of our show. This is a series that's by Jim Butcher, the guy who did the Dresden Files, set in sort of pseudo Rome. It's like sort of fantasy Rome, and really, really great, really great series. Six books in that series. Enjoyed every single one of them. I read The Name of the Wind, which by Patrick Rothfuss, which has got a lot of big hype in the last few years as being a kind of him being a new icon in fantasy writing. As well as the sequel to it called The Wise Man's Fear. Then they're both really, really excellent. It's supposed to be a trilogy, and I'll be very interested to see if he can wrap all of the storylines up in the third book.
Game of Thrones was originally a trilogy, so
okay,
you know how that went.
Yeah, because it's, well, he's set it up ahead of time where if it's not a trilogy, then he's going to have to, you know, he's going to have to really do something.
I've read like the first few chapters, and I always read it after I've read something heavy fantasy.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, well, I just need a fantasy break. And I've not gotten around. What I've read has been interesting, but I've not read that much.
See, for me, Name of the Wind is pretty much a fantasy break from Game of Thrones. Because in comparison, it's very light and it's real easy to read. And the dialogue is real easy. I finally finished Feast for Crows on audiobook with Roy Dotrice, who's like 89 years old. He's amazing, but it takes a little getting used to listening to his characters. So I downloaded Dance with Dragons and I'm about, you know, the equivalent of maybe 75 pages into it or something like that. And I just need a break from Roy Dotrice for a little while.
Yeah.
And so
you still want to be friends.
Yeah, exactly.
But you gave him back his class ring and
yeah, exactly.
You said, let's just be friends for a while.
On the book front right now, very exciting week for me. The new November the 27th was the release of the new Dresden Files novel, Cold Days, and the new Iron Druid Chronicles novel called Trapped. And so I downloaded Trapped to my Nook and have not downloaded the Dresden book because I've been waiting for like a year and a half for this Dresden book. And so I don't want to just buy it.
It's like a nice steak. You don't want to just scarf it down.
No, I don't want to just read it in like a week and then have to wait another year and a half. So, yeah. You know, they left the last book on such a weird ending that I'll be very interested to see how that.
I need to get back to them because it's like I read the first two, which everyone says like, well, you got to get through the first two and then it gets good. And I read them and they were fine, you know.
I don't know. I think that if you aren't somewhat hooked at this point, I'm not sure if when you get to the next books that you're not. It may be a little overhyped for you. I don't know.
Maybe I'll read the third one and then.
Yeah, read the third one. See what you think about that.
These
one.
People aren't going to know. We're not.
we're not even calling them listeners anymore. It's just like these people.
What do you mean,
these,
you people?
You people. These people. You wonderful people out there. We're just making this for Trent, right? That's it.
We're not putting on any.
Sending it directly to. Well, one last thing, I'll just talk about TV shows and movies real quick because I've been watching this TV show Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. My wife and I got horribly addicted to that and watched all four seasons of it pretty much in succession.
Lots of meth flowing in the Richard home.
Lots of meth, and I gotta say it is in my like top five TV shows of all time.
You're talking about meth for a second. It's in my top five drugs of all time.
It's just a fantastic show, and I'm a chemist, so it's, you know, the chemistry angle is kind of interesting for me for that, but it's also just an amazingly well-acted show and well-written show. So.
John Richards, top 100 drugs of all time.
Well, that'd be a pretty good list. I don't know. I probably could come up with it.
You're right, Tom. We should move on. We're going to get kicked off the feed.
Let's move on. And there's been a lot of stuff on podcasts about this show, Revolution.
Yeah,
which is about the big blackout where something causes all the electricity to go out in the world and the militias take over and the United States falls and all that kind of stuff. And I've been watching it and I got through almost to the mid-season finale. And I got to tell you, I was excited about it and I'm just not anymore.
It's Lost for Dummies. I mean, the premise is interesting, but
is a good way of putting it, Lost for Dummies.
It's just acted so kind of... not well.
The girl fights with her uncle. Yeah. The uncle says, stay here. The girl says, no, I'm going. And then the guy says, no, don't, you're not going. And then he leaves and then she goes anyway. And then they,
everyone's a 15th level sword fighter. I mean,
that's true. Everybody's got some mad offensive skills.
I would love to just sit and read the story Bible for that show. Cause I think it would be interesting. But it's like, like the thing.
Oh, the
when they pitch it, they have the story Bible,
right? That's right.
No, not the gospel of,
I thought you were thinking, no. I'll read the trade paperback of that one. But.
No, but yeah, because I think the premise is fantastic and the whole setting is very interesting, but man, I have no desire to watch it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it through the season, but, and the other thing is, as far as movies go, excited about The Hobbit coming up. Are you excited or not?
I'm not as excited. I mean, I will see it. I very much prefer The Lord of the Rings to The Hobbit, and I think a lot of people would say that, but the fact that I was kind of flabbergasted when it was two movies, now that it's three and they're throwing in all this Silmarillion stuff, I'm just...
Yeah, they're even throwing in characters.
Yeah, like Legolas is in it, and I don't believe he was in The Hobbit. And it's just, I don't know, I will see it. I probably won't see it opening weekend. I'll see it when I see it. It's...
I may see it opening weekend just because I'm reading the book to my kids right now.
Oh, there you go.
And so we're about a fifth of the way through it right now, and they really like it.
Are you singing the songs?
I tried singing the very first song, and it is when the dwarves come in and they all sing the song. And I tried just singing and making up a tune, and my daughter hated it. She's like, could you please stop that? Oh,
that's actually where the first movie ends. They got to stretch it out. That's it. The dwarves come in, they wreck the place.
That's the whole thing. Yep. So I've just been kind of doing sort of a sing-song poem whenever there's any sort of a song, and that's been acceptable
good
to
effort.
Her.
Good effort.
That's it. I saw the other day that the new Star Trek movie is coming out in May called Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about that.
I really hope. I mean, the names attached to it sound pretty good. You know, like Benedict Cumberbatch is in it. Yeah. You know, that's pretty solid. But
there's also Smaug in The Hobbit.
Yeah. The rumor is that he's like the villain is Khan. Or that Khan is in it. And I really hope that's not the case, because there's no reason to do that except, well, Khan was in the second movie the first time we made the Star Trek movie, so he's got to be in it.
But it's alternate reality Khan, right? So he'll...
But there's no setup for it. I don't know. It's dumb. I
hope it's not Khan.
I am on record of saying I think what they need to do. I was fine. I'm a big Star Trek fan. I was fine with the reboot movie, you know, and they did the alternate timeline thing very well. That was smartly done. But I really think that it could be back on TV again, but they don't need to be cute with it, you know. So it's like Voyager, you know, it's Star Trek, but they're, you know, 80 years from home. Or Enterprise, well, it's a prequel, and why does the prototype Enterprise look better than the first one? But anyway, they just need to make the next generation. I mean, obviously don't call it that, but have like...
they should call it that.
The next generation.
The next generation.
You set it, you know, 70 years after the end of Next Generation, you have the Enterprise F or the G or whatever.
You bring on all the Next Generation cast as guest stars with, like, you know, old people makeup on. Like,
right, yeah, but the
core... Like when DeForest Kelly was on.
Right, but the core cast is all new people, and you have all... And it's just all, you know, Planet of the Week sort of things. I think it could work.
I'd watch it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
we might be the only two people watching it, but, you know, I think they just try to get too cute with it. I think if they could just, you know, just stick to what they know, stick to Strange New Worlds and all that.
So. See, but the thing with the movies was that, whereas a TV show, you're going to get, you know, the geeky people like us who are going to watch it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But with that movie, because they put in a bunch of hot young things in the roles, I had a lot of non-gamer, non-geek friends watch that movie and really liked it, you know? Huh. And so I think they're probably pulling in a lot more of an audience than they would have with a, you know, with a TV show.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce Greenwood, I mean, or is it Greenwood?
Yeah, he played Pike?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Greenwood.
That's
yeah.
a hot little number right there.
Let me tell you. Woo.
Well, on that note.
I think that's the rundown.
I hope to God it is.
Oh my goodness. So time to move on, shall we?
Let's do it.
You're listening to Game On with Cody and John, not a member of the Dice Tower Network. Thank God.
It is time for the big deal, and since this episode is all for Trent Ham, Trent Ham tells us what to do around here.
That's right. Trent is our benevolent overlord.
That's right. The pride of Huxley, Iowa. He demands, nay,
no, he demands.
Orders.
He orders
us.
It's different from demand.
I guess. He does. There's some structure with it.
I see.
Shut up. The big deal topic. He writes, since you guys are an indie, go Colts, this should be easy. What advice would you have to someone who was thinking of going to Gen Con 2013 and this was their first Gen Con? What should a board gamer really make sure to see? What tips or tactics do you have for a great Gen Con?
Well, our first tip would be don't come because it's really crowded, man. I'm just kidding.
Shut up.
It's fine. Well, there's lots of... So specifically for a board gamer, right? That's kind of what he's... You know.
Well, I would say even before that,
okay,
let's get the overall logistics down pat.
Okay.
Okay. So the first thing you want to do is if you go to GenCon.com, they have all the pertinent dates for information. Now, that may seem like a duh thing, but the big thing to know is that if you're planning to come and you're planning to get a hotel, especially either a connected hotel or one right downtown... They fill up very fast. And so how the Gen Con, how the housing block works is when badge pre-registration opens. So for this year, that is January 27th at noon Eastern.
What do you know what day of the week that is?
Any idea? Is a day of the week to be determined.
Keep talking. I'll look that
sure.
up.
Sure. Yeah. So it's January 27th at noon Eastern. And they specify a time because...
It's a Sunday.
It is a Sunday. It's a Sunday. Very good. People, you know, they're not going to run out of badges. They don't really sell out the show so much. But when you get your badge, you get a housing code, which you can use for the Indianapolis like housing authority or
Indy Pass or something like that.
Something, yeah.
We unfortunately don't know that as well because we live here. But
yeah, but the general theory is that you know you get a code to get a hotel, and that's when you know, you can get one of the prized hotels that are around there. Cost is probably anywhere from about $115 to $199 a night.
Yep, depending on the hotel.
The con rate. But really, if you can afford it, and, you know, especially if it's your first con, that would be a big boon to you, especially if you don't have to rent a car. You can just be close by. Indy is, you know, I've sung the praise of Indy for... you know, years on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the nice things is that, you know, it's so compact and so built for conventions that, You know, you can, if you go buy a couple Fantasy Flight games at the booth, you can run to your hotel room, drop them off, and be back at the con in, you know, 5-10 minutes. It's like you didn't miss a step. If you need to go take a nap halfway through, it's fine.
Yep.
So I would say if you get a hotel, definitely consider spending the extra money to get one of the connected ones, because I really think it can be a boon to you. But with that being said, make sure you're on it and get your badge on the 27th and then and get that hotel room, because they fill up really fast.
Like on that day, on the 27th.
On so the day at noon.
At
yeah.
noon. So yeah. you need to be sitting by your computer to do that.
Yeah.
If you are, you know, planning on getting a hotel. Mm-hmm. If you're not planning on getting a hotel room, then much like Cody and I never get my badge on the day that the badge registration opens up personally, because right. it doesn't matter to me. I'm not going to stay in a hotel. So as long as I get it before they stop doing badge pre-ordering,
which is
online.
June 29th.
Yeah. So I can, you know, pretty much up until June 29th, from that January 27th to June 29th, you can get your badge online. Yeah. If you're brand new, and like, you know, Trent's asked us to kind of key in on new folks coming to Gen Con, if you've never been to Gen Con before, you can go ahead of time to GenConReg.com, that's GenConReg.com, and can create an account for yourself. You can do that right now.
Yeah.
And if you create an account for yourself, then you'll be ready to log in. You might be able to store your credit card information. I'm not sure.
I believe you can. Yeah.
But you can definitely get your address and everything already loaded into the system so that you're good to go for when the badge registration opens. So getting a badge is definitely the first thing. Now there's different kinds of badges. The 4-day badge is the, you know, the one that you probably should get if you're coming into town for the full time.
There's pretty much, I mean, I think this year. So this year, a 4-day badge is $70. If you pre-reg, $80. If you
wait until getting it there, yeah.
1-day badges are $40 a day if you pre-reg and $50 on-site.
So if you're going to be there for at least 2 days, then it's a no-brainer. It's less money for you to go ahead and get the 40 badge.
You can get, I don't think this would be applicable to you necessarily, but they do have the family fun day badges where, you know, your whole family can get in for a reduced rate. It's good if you're kind of a, I think it's best for local families. They're just trying to see what all the stormtroopers are about. You know?
Yeah. Or if you live, within short driving distance of Indianapolis and you just wanted to bring your family in for, a Sunday afternoon trip just to check out Gen Con, the family fun idea is would be your best bet.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention the VIG badge.
Oh,
the
please.
Very important gamer
Don't
badge.
Don't be remiss.
They have, it's a limited amount. And it's kind of like a club almost, to where if you bought it last year or in a previous year, you know, you get right of first refusal. You can choose whether to re-up it or not. And the bet that is this year, $540 per ticket.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So but what you get for it, and you can decide if it's worth it or not. Most people would say it's not worth it. you get definite. So your top three hotels, you will get a room in one of those three. You're guaranteed to get that.
The 540
540
does not include your
does
hotel
not include
room.
Your hotel, but
it just includes the ability to get a hotel room in the hotel that you want.
There is I know there's a bunch of like the VIG swag bag. It's pretty good. Like there's actual like full games in it, and it's pretty nice. There's a special VIG lounge during the con where you can go in and it's catered with food and drink, and they have industry stars come in there and things like that. You know,
that can be a neat thing because sometimes, you know, if you don't want to spend $3 for a soda.
Yeah.
I'm not saying $540 is equal to a $3 soda, but it is nice if you are able to do that, to have some place to just kind of
You can
go
check
chill
bags
out.
For free.
Yeah, that's nice.
You get on the first day of the con on Thursday, you get to go into the dealer hall an hour early. Mm-hmm. There was kind of a kerfuffle this year because Fantasy Flight early on in the convention wasn't enforcing. They didn't have any like purchase limits.
Mm-hmm.
So you had like VIGs and other people that got to go in early, basically going to the VIG booth, buying like 6 copies of Netrunner and then selling them on eBay.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I know that I walked in right when the dealer hall opened, made a beeline immediately to the Fantasy Flight booth because I wanted to get Android Netrunner, and they were, the stack that they told me was like higher than a 6-foot person was down to like three games mm-hmm. high, and I was amazed that I even got one. So
yeah, so there are some other perks. They're kind of escaping me right now, to be honest.
You buy this every year, right? So you should know.
You know what? I'm not going to buy it this year. It's like we're buying a house. You know, it's probably not in the cards this year, but we've thought about it and the idea, because for Caitlin and I, Gen Con is our vacation. Yeah. I mean, certainly we're going to take vacation other places, but that's our big yearly thing. We always do it. I kind of at least want to try it 1 year to see if it's worth it. I mean, there are other perks with it. There, for some of the seminar events like the costume contest or Killer Breakfast, you get like priority seating for that. I hate Killer Breakfast, so that's not a perk for me. Caitlin likes the costume contest. There are other things. There are special like True Dungeon runs you can go on, things like that. But so I say all that just to say if you've got that much to spend and you want to try it out, I've heard nothing but good things. I know people who have done the thing, but you got to, I think it would be hard to hear a bad review, you know, cause then they'd be like, well, I spent $500. I got jack crap, you know?
Right.
So that is an option. So that being said, if you're going to be there more than 2 days, you might as well just get the 4 day badge.
Exactly.
All right. What should be next? Probably event registration.
Yep. So after you've gotten your badge, hopefully on January the 27th or shortly thereafter, the next thing will be event registration, which begins in, I believe, April?
Yeah, I don't see a date yet. I don't think they've announced an actual date. But okay. That's when the big... it's kind of a blitz, very similar to badge registration, hotel reg. That's when your items, you know, your true dungeons, your kind of hard-to-find RPGs and board games, so that's where that will sell out. So if you don't care about True Dungeon or events that are kind of hard to get into, you really don't have to, and I would say stay away from Event Reg that day because you don't really need to stress yourself out and do it. You can, what's nice is with that site that John was talking about, you can browse events, you can see what's out there. And if it's your first Gen Con, you know, what kind of events would be good? I think for board gaming, the board game library has improved so much over the past few years. Like it's just... It went from, you know, 3 years ago not really being anything worth speaking of, to something that's really just grown and it's pretty solid right now.
They learned a lot from Origins. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the best things about Origins when Origins was in its heyday was the boardroom run by the Columbus Area Board Game Society, and I think they've really listened to the gamers and also you know sort of picked up on what was good about what was going on at Origins. They have a dedicated room now that has expanded and was pretty big last year. And even though it was full for a good portion of the con, I think it was fine. I think it was a good size space and it was full almost the entire time of people playing board games. So if you want to come to just play board games, that would be a good thing to get. If not to play during the day, to have something to do once the dealer hall closes and once those, you know, once the main events are done during the day, to have some place to go in the evening.
Yeah. Other things I would suggest would be, you know, we've always promoted the well-rounded gamer. So, you know, we've mentioned this on shows before. If you see an RPG that looks interesting or a minis game, buy a ticket for it. You know, $2-4, you know, what's the worst that could happen?
Now, talk again, for brand new people here, talk about event tickets. How is that different from the badge?
Oh, okay. So you have your badge, you know, that gets you access to the show and the dealer hall and the tickets. I think the going rate, the unofficial rate's like $2 per 2 hours. Or
I think so. It's about a buck an hour or something.
Yeah,
like that. Yeah. $1.50 an hour.
So the idea is there's Gen Con, the show, and then for all of these events, for these tens of thousands of events that are going on all weekend, you buy tickets for, because the GMs get compensated a little bit. Most of it goes back to Gen Con and the hotel running the event. And it's also to, you know, maintain table limits. You know, if there's a Settlers of Catan game, you know, there's only going to be up to 6 tickets for it, mm-hmm. Sort of a thing. So it's, like I said, for the games that aren't very popular, usually you can just, you know, you can still buy them ahead of time, but you don't have to buy them first thing when event registration opens. There are also these things called generic tickets to where, they just cost, you know, like $2 for a ticket or something like that. And for mini games, you can just go up with the equivalent cost in generic tickets. And if there's a seat available, boom, you've got it. Mm-hmm. That even works for something like True Dungeon, you know, where it's like $38 a ticket. If there's an open slot and you have $38 worth of generics, then you're in.
Yeah.
So I always recommend that people get, I think getting like $10 to $12 in generics is usually more than enough for the first time. You know? What's nice about generics is anything you don't use, you can turn back in as system credit for future Gen Con and ticket purchases. So it's kind of nice.
And that can be a nice perk if you've turned stuff in and forgotten that you turned it in, and then you go to
register.
So I was like, oh, wow. I didn't.
I always enjoy like the $7 to $10 I have sitting
there.
Yeah,
it's nice.
we mentioned True Dungeon. I've spoken at length about that. I would say if it's something that remotely interests you, maybe find a buddy or two and get in. If you really want to do it, you can go around and wait at the area. And if you have the generics, then you can find a group fast. It's to the point now where you can get in pretty quickly if you want.
Right. Now, event registration is the one area of the Gen Con experience that I think can frustrate people quite a bit. And if you go to the Gen Con forums, that's community.gencon.com is the Gen Con forums, which has a lot of good information also, and threads of people who are interested in Gen Con who are posting things. Whenever event registration happens, it's kind of a, it's like Black Friday or whatever. You're waiting at the gate there, or you're waiting to get into a concert or something. And they open the gate and they press go, and then, it's release the hounds. Everybody
yeah,
does
it's a crapshoot. Yeah.
And then it is, yeah, like you said, it's kind of a crapshoot. You're hoping that you're going to get the things that you want. But I've found that over the last few years, I only get a portion of the things that I want. And,
yeah. And I mean, you got to think it's like hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people going for 10 tickets.
Yeah, for a particular mm-hmm. event. Yeah. And so for the really, what I found is that the things that tend to go the fastest are really hot role-playing game events, and
Burning Wheel, Mouse Guard, that always seems to sell out.
Things that aren't, that a lot of people aren't running. This past year, there's only just a few people that were running the Dresden Files RPG, and so those sold out almost immediately. And so for things like that, for new games that are being featured by a company, I know the Marvel Heroic role-playing system from last year, those games sold out very, very quickly. So, those are games that we have some friends that run a group of games called U2K and Cthulhu, which are Call of Cthulhu games. Those always sell out.
And they're fantastic.
I haven't been able to get into one of those games for 2 or 3 years because it's just so popular now. So it's sort of you make your wish list, a few weeks, days to weeks before the event registration, they'll release the catalog. So you can go in and search for the things that you want and sort of plan out your schedule. But then it's just sort of you plug it into the system, and when it's time to press go, because you have like a, did you mention this already? They give like a wish list.
Mm-mm,
okay, no. You have like a wish list that you put up in the registration system, where you pick out the games that you want. And you sort of build your schedule and put it in your wish list, or your it's not your card, it's your wish list. I think it's what it's called.
Yeah.
And then you can bring that screen up, and there'll be a countdown on the screen. Registration begins in this time, and you basically wait until the thing hits zero, and then you press submit wish list, and it will submit all of these want lists or these wish lists to the system and begin to process them in order. And you'll get and you'll have this panic attack thinking, did my computer crash or did the internet go down or something, or what's going on, where am I in the process? And you'll get to see slowly whether you got the things that you wanted or not. So it's really like spinning a bit of a roulette wheel. But,
And we don't want to scare you away.
No.
We say for most of the things you probably want to try, you will be able to get into.
Yes.
This is just for, like I said, a few of the big ticket RPG items, True Dungeon, some other things, where tickets are limited and there's a lot of demand. But most of the time you should be fine. And a note about events, we mentioned trying out new things and things of that nature. There are a lot of things you wouldn't necessarily expect at a convention. And, a lot of these are filed under the SPA, the spousal activities,
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are things that, there have been historic walking tours of Indianapolis. There have been, make your own dice bag things, all sort of like things on costuming.
Dance classes and different, I think there's maybe been fitness workouts and stuff like that. So lots of different things. It's not just gaming. The great thing about Gen Con, and a lot of real hardcore board gamers especially, they will kind of poo-poo Gen Con and say, well, you need to go to BGG Con because it's all board games, or you need to go someplace where it's really focused on gaming. And they don't like Gen Con because it is such a spectacle. But I think that's what makes it the best convention to come to.
Yeah.
Is because not only do you get to participate in all the gaming stuff that you want to, but you get to see all this other stuff that's going on and possibly participate in it, or at least view it and enjoy it. And you get to just see what this gaming culture has to offer. And it's far more than just board games,
So. And I think on a note on scheduling events, I think both John and I would agree in the idea, don't over-schedule, but don't under-schedule either. I've done both. I know the first couple years we went, I know we both were guilty of over-scheduling, and we were just trying to fill every minute full of something. And a couple years ago, actually, I got so burnt out that I didn't schedule many events at all. And I couldn't really think of something to do. I just kind of was wandering around.
Yeah.
So I go with the idea of having a morning-ish event and an evening-ish event. And, you know, that could be any starting from anywhere from 8 a.m. to 11, or there's no hard and fast rule about it. But it allows you some time to where in between you can go to the dealer hall, look around. You can just kind of, you know, if you see something in the catalog that interests you, you can get some generics and go check it out. You can, you know, go have a nice meal. You can, you know, there are plenty of nice restaurants in Indianapolis.
Yeah, you should definitely check out stuff like that. There's lots of stuff that Indy has to offer that's within walking distance of the convention center. Mm-hmm. I know if you're listening to this podcast, you may listen to other podcasts. I know like Tom and Eric at the Dice Tower, they do a Gen Con dinner. I had a really great time this past year going to their dinner, and the Spiel podcast and some of the other ones, they'll have events that you can participate in just around the city. So that's a lot of fun to go do that as well.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of things. We don't have the time to get into it here, but you know, like if you're looking for older games, there's the Gen Con auction. If you like, say you're into BattleTech, they have these giant pods. If you've been to Origins or the convention, you've seen them. These giant BattleTech pods where you get in and it's like you're driving a mech and you're fighting it. It's fantastic. There's a video game area. If you want to go in and play some arcade games, you can do that. There's any gaming itch you want to scratch, you're going to find here at the convention.
Yeah, this year I got to play in a game called Artemis, which is a...
I want to do this.
It's like a starship simulation game where each person has a different computer that is one's weapons, one's, you know, engineering, one's comm, and you all work together to try to, you know, kill spaceships and stuff. And it's really, really fun. You know, and it's not really a board game thing. It's not an RPG thing. It's a completely different thing. And they had a whole room devoted just for that.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much going on, and we mentioned all the things to do downtown. What's really great is that downtown really embraces the convention.
Yeah.
You know, when it first came here, it's not like people downtown were hostile toward Gen Con. They just really didn't know what it was. But now in the past few years, they see how much money it brings in for the city, how much good publicity it brings for the city. And you have all sorts of restaurants and hotels. They just welcome the convention with open arms. And even places like, there's a famous restaurant here called St. Elmo's, kind of it's an expensive place. It's a well-to-do place, but they run specials. Like if you come in costume, you know, you can come get this for cheap. And it's really cool to see a city and a convention just kind of so organically grown together to where you can enjoy yourself not only within the convention walls, but you can go all around the city and you still feel that kind of Gen Con spirit, as it were.
You know, we had the benefit this year of hosting, or this, you know, in 2012 of hosting Super Bowl 46 here in Indianapolis, which is a really great time. But one of the things that they did as part of the renovation for the Super Bowl is they took this stretch of Georgia Street, which is a city, it's an east to west street that runs right in the middle of downtown, and they converted it to sort of a part-time pedestrian only street. And that's where our Super Bowl Village was. And it pretty much extends from the convention center doors all the way down to to the Bankers Life Fieldhouse where the Indiana Pacers play. And it's about a 4-block area there. And this year at Gen Con, they did something new that they hadn't done before in that, I don't know if you've seen on Food Network and other kind of TV shows, that there's this been sort of renaissance of the food truck. You know, and these restaurants having food trucks that sell, you know, different kinds of items out of there. And so they had this rotating group of food trucks that were parked right outside of the convention center. I think they had 5 or 6 of them at a time where you could go and get different kinds of foods, you know, different fare from what you would get in the convention center or from local restaurants. And that was fun too, you know.
Well, it filled that gap because it was pretty much your options used to be. That, you know, they have kind of food vendors in the convention center, but it's always overpriced and it's the quality, you know, it's like stadium food or something, you know, it's okay, but it's really overpriced. Or you could go out to many of the restaurants, and even though Indianapolis is a pretty, you know, pedestrian friendly city, you know, that could be an hour or two, especially at peak time. So these food trucks were great because you could just go out there. You could, you know, the weather was so nice during Gen Con, you could just grab something at, you know, you had all these kind of different ethnic foods and different just things you would never try before. You can just grab it, eat outside, and then get back to gaming if that's what you want to do. It was really cool. So
yep. And I know, like Cody said, I don't want to scare people off with what I said about event registration. Even if you didn't sign up for anything during event registration, and as a new person, you may not. You might just like, I'm not sure if I want to, you know, get involved.
Maybe just like the board game library.
Yeah. When the board game library will not sell out during the first days of event registration.
It won't sell out, but I would get tickets.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get tickets ahead of time, but you don't have to worry about sitting there and pressing go at the day, you know, to get a board game ticket.
Because they reach capacity a few times during the con. I know I had to wait for a little bit. They had to kind of sneak me in. It was basically, I got in, and then a buddy of mine that was with me, I was basically like, you know, 500 to 500 or whatever. Uh-huh. And they kind of, you know, snuck him in because that wouldn't be fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely get it for the board game room, but you don't have to get it day one.
Yeah. And, but even if you didn't sign up for any tickets and you just showed up at the convention, you're going to find things to do. Don't worry about it. There's yeah. you know, even if you're just going to go in the dealer hall every day, that's enough to occupy your time. I know we gush a whole lot over Gen Con, but it really is just, it's the best 4 days in gaming. And it's just so much fun to see all the stuff that Indianapolis and that the Gen Con has to offer.
And if I had to leave it with one thing, you know, especially since if it's your first time going, you know, you're going to want to just go. I would say kind of force yourself to slow down, you know, do the necessities, you know, you know, make sure you're eating, make sure you're, you know, staying hydrated, but just really take it all in, you know, just really force yourself to really enjoy what you're doing. And I think you're going to have a great time. And I think if it's your first Gen Con, I don't think it'll be your last, because I think you'll really have a great time.
Yeah. And this may just be a life philosophy thing for me, but I tend to walk into new experiences with pretty low expectations. That sounds like, you know, aiming low there, John, but I don't know. I've found that the people that get frustrated with things at Gen Con, and I've seen people get just really ticked off about mm-hmm. stuff, is they have these really crazy expectations for things. And I don't know. For me, I work a job every day, you know, and I'm cranking it out, you know, at my desk or in the lab where I'm, you know, and, you know, just trying to tough it out every day. And just to be able to go for 4 days and walk around this great convention center full of all this cool hobby stuff and games and costumes, it's gonna be fun, you know. Yeah. Don't take it too seriously.
So, yeah, I would say if you had any questions, I don't know.
Well, if you want to email us, we still have our inbox open. I'd be happy to
yeah.
answer some questions via email.
There might be a thread in the Dice Tower forum or the Game On Guild. I think is still,
yeah, still active. So that our email address is gameoninbox@gmail.com. So
that's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Thank you for repeating it, because I'm sure they didn't.
That
hear
was
it
a throwback.
That's yeah. nice.
Thank you.
But I think those would be our main tips for any new person coming to Gen Con. We would. If you have the means, whether you live close by to Indianapolis or whether you live across the globe, you know, we'd invite anybody as gaming ambassadors to the great gaming capital of the world. We say come one, come all to Indianapolis sure. and check out Gen Con.
I'm going to go put on my robe, so why don't you lead us out of this?
Oh, and indeed, yes.
Welcome to the GM Academy, the premier institute of higher learning for both role players and game masters alike. Send your RPG queries and petitions to gameoninbox@gmail.com. And now, please welcome the Chancellor of the GM Academy, Cody L. Jones, Esquire III.
Yes, it's once again time for the GM Academy.
It's good to be back.
And Chancellor Jones, it is good to have you here with us
once again. I have my tam donned.
The tam looks lovely.
Thank you.
It really does, especially with the Scottish flag in the background.
Oh, yes, very good. My hood.
Yes, it's very nice. Well, our lovely sponsor, Trent Ham,
yes,
has written in with a question for you, Chancellor Jones, as part of the GM Academy.
Mm-hmm.
We've opened the doors to the Academy one more time.
One more time.
And here is what he writes.
Distance learning.
And distance learning. He says, how do you get an RPG group started if you've just moved to a new area and you can't locate any existing groups? He says, ideas on how to find players, what basic equipment you need to start one, what systems or scenarios to use, if some or all of the people are new, etc., etc.
That's a tricky one.
Yes.
It's a common problem, though, and I'm going to do my best to solve it for you now.
Please.
First thing, I'll take the middle part first. Or, all right, what show was that?
I need that.
I'll take the last part first.
Oh, what was that? That
was 21 or
some game show.
I don't know. Anyway,
get some dice.
Yeah. Systems to use. I'll give you three to take a look at, and it should cover a fairly wide swath of systems. So if you're looking more in the fantasy department.
Vampire the Masquerade.
Vampire the Masquerade. Vampire the Masquerade is fantastic. But
not a good starter system.
Not a good starter, no. I would say for fantasy RPGs, the Pathfinder Beginner Box is actually, it's not just for kids. It's it's great for kids or adults looking to get into the game. And it is touted as saying if you have no RPG experience, you can be up and playing in 15 minutes. Really? And I actually read an interview, or not read an interview, but I read a review to where they put that to the test, where the guy had it and sprung it on people who'd never played and started a timer, and within 12 minutes they were up and playing.
Wow.
And so obviously it's not the full Pathfinder rules, but it's like the Pathfinder core rulebook, one of the best fantasy RPGs out there. You know, that's like a 576-page tome, you know, the core rulebook. So it's going to scare some people away. The beginner box lets you play levels 1 to 5 and is really good for bringing you into it. Because basically once your character has gotten to level 5, if you're still interested in playing, then you're probably ready. You probably know the rules well enough to where you can start to learn a few more of the advanced things and you're good to go. The second thing I would recommend would be, we did a full kind of episode. I think our first like GM Academy episode was on Savage Worlds. You can get now, they've just released, a few years ago, they released Savage World Deluxe, which is basically just kind of the new edition of it. And just,
we've added a cover to the book.
Exactly. And then just last year they introduced Savage Worlds Deluxe Explorers Edition, which is the little, the smaller kind of handheld version of it. Which you can get for $10. Mm-hmm. So any RPG you can get for $10 is good by me. And it's a great system. You can play anything from fantasy to sci-fi to horror to western to whatever you want. It's easy to learn, and it's kind of built for and great for the for like adults who, you know, don't have a lot of time to, you know, prep a big campaign or whatever. They just want to kind of play, you know, a few hours a month or whatever. It's a great system. It's very versatile. And I've always said, if you only get one system, that's the one to get. If you can never see yourself, you know, if you want to kind of Jones theory your RPG genres and you want one RPG, I would say that's the one. I like having different systems for different styles, but Savage Worlds is, you could do far worse than that. The last one would be in the more, so you've kind of had the more crunchy ones, I would say, the rules, heavy ones with Pathfinder. You've got kind of middle of the road with Savage Worlds. If you're looking for something really story-based, I would recommend Mouse Guard, the Mouse Guard box set. It's got some rules for it, but it's very story-driven. It's very narrative-driven, and you can play it with kids. You can play it with adults, and it's fun either way. So I think that gives you three. Those are three products that give you kind of an entrance into RPGs. Now, you mentioned, you know, if you play RPGs, you have to have a group.
Wait a minute.
Go on.
Can we go back for a second?
Roll back.
So you mentioned three products.
I did.
None of those products had the words Dungeons or Dragons in them.
It's true.
I just wanted to...
Yeah.
Would you care to comment on that?
Pathfinder out D&D, D&D.
Whoa.
So, I mean... Really? I mean, they're beating WotC at their own game.
Well, that's why I was just curious as to what would make... I know you just gave your top three there, mm-hmm. but what makes D&D not in that top three?
Well, I mean, the
it's been the archetype for D&D.
There's no current edition. I mean, there's if you walked into a game store and said, I want to play D&D, then they would give you either a fourth edition book or a D&D Essentials book, you know, 4.5.
Well, my game store, they would probably try to sell me magic cards.
Right. They wouldn't acknowledge it for 10 minutes and then they...
Yeah.
But anyway, so if you walked into a Myriad Games, you know, and said, I want to play D&D, they would say, okay, I'll give you, you know, this... They would give you the most current product. That's all they can do.
Right.
But you know, they're doing this massive, like, play test. This is the D&D Next thing.
Yeah.
And I've played I've played a iteration of it. They've probably changed it by now. And it plays a lot like the earlier editions of D&D, which isn't a bad thing. It plays a lot like Castles and Crusades, actually, which is a retro clone game. But that's kind of the thing. D&D really has no significant market presence right now. It's like their best market presence is their board games. Like Lords of Waterdeep, fantastic game. Dungeon Command, I've heard, is a very fun miniatures game. But in the RPG, they have very little market presence. And Pathfinder is just churning out. They're doing great stuff. It's not even that they're scraping the bottom of the barrel. All the Paizo stuff is really well done. Really well done.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe when D&D Next comes out in a retail environment, it might do something. But until then...
Maybe that new person who's coming to Gen Con will come to Gen Con and see the release of D&D Next.
They might. Or they might just go to the very austere Paizo booth and buy a bunch of stuff.
Buy a bunch of
I bought a stuffed goblin from there.
It's very cute.
Gobby.
Yeah. Gobby the Goblin.
Yeah.
Please continue.
That was a good point. I've kind of just blocked it out.
Okay. So, I was just curious. Yeah.
Yeah. So the big question is finding a group, and there's a couple of schools of thought on the way to do it. The best way or the easiest way, if you have a gaming group, is if you can convince them just to try an RPG. I mean, there you have the people, you know them, you've gamed with them. The fact you're still gaming with them, you probably can tolerate them to a point. But if you're new to an area, I would either suggest going to the friendly local game store and seeing if there's an existing game running, or a lot of them have some sort of a bulletin board where you can kind of post, say, hey, I'm interested in playing these games, you know, call me here. Or you could, there's a lot of online resources in finding a group. But one of the best ways may be, and this is angled a little more towards Pathfinder, but there is the Pathfinder Society. It's kind of the organized play arm of Paizo. And it's meant for where I can make a character, I can play at a table in Des Moines, Iowa, and then, hey, I'm on vacation in Los Angeles. I could find a Pathfinder Society group there, and if they're playing, my character is legal to play, and it crosses over.
It's like an AA meeting for...
kind of, yeah.
Probably not like that at all.
Friends of Ragnar T or something, I don't know. But you can... It's nice because it's part of an overarching story, but they're short little bite-sized things. So it's like you're still playing in this big overarching story, but they're these kind of, you know, just concentrated 3 to 4 hour adventures to where if you don't have a lot of time, you can get in and just play that and you're done. You don't have to do it with the same group. Hmm. You could play with different people every single time if you want. Some people like it so much they just do it as their home game. Like they just like that system. So
in those games, I never played in a game like that before. Mm-hmm. You just bring your character with you and that character just kind of plops into a group and...
Mm-hmm.
There's no context for why they're together other than we're adventurers.
The not to get too off track, but the whole idea of Pathfinders is that it's basically this organization where they go out from lodges, these Pathfinder lodges, right? Huh. And they get sent out to go recover artifacts or treasure or explore things. So, I mean, it's perfect for RPGs because it's like, well, why are we going to this dangerous evil temple again? It's like, oh, we were sent there. It's a job. We're going to get things. So that's
where we were in the tavern, and the wizard walked in.
Exactly. And so in the Paizo world, in Galarian, the name of the world, since there are thousands of Pathfinders at any given time, it makes it more palatable that, you know, you sit at a table with four other strangers, and you know your characters are meeting for the first time, but you have a reason to go do something together.
Ah, okay, that's cool.
Yeah. So you've got that. If you're not interested in the fantasy side, it's a little tougher, but I know the Savage Roads community, I know the Pinnacle Entertainment that runs it at PEGINC.com. I think you can find groups there. They have an active forum, and pretty much a lot of the major RPGs have forums to where you can look for groups.
Have you perused RPG Geek at all?
I've not, but you know,
I haven't really either.
That's a good idea though.
Yeah. I know that on the board game side, there's lots of, local groups that post, you know, threads and things like that. Yep. So that might be something you could try.
You might get on the tenure track here at the GM Academy. Keep it up with that. It
might be 20 year for me.
Might be, probably not though. And was there anything else or was that kind of
tips and, let's see here. Ideas on how to find players, equipment you'd need to start one, and what system or scenario if mm-hmm. People are new. But
I mean, equipment's going to be the base book of the system, or a beginner box if that system has one.
Well, do you think all the players would need, if let's say that Trent wanted to start just a group
mm-hmm.
of new, he moves to a new place and he's got new people, but you know,
I always say, you know, yeah, not everyone has to have a beginner's box.
Maybe clarify that. What?
Yeah. So
does one person need the book or the box or?
So if you're, that's a good point. If you're starting a group from scratch, you only really need one of the books. In the case where there's a beginner specific product, you definitely only need one. You'll mm-hmm. never need to buy more than one. But as I keep going, for Savage Worlds, not to do a Pathfinder example. So you only need one copy of the book to run it. You may find it's helpful to have multiple copies at the table, but to start, you only need one.
Is that the kind of thing where one person has a copy, but you play it for a few times, and then after a while, player X is sitting there going, yeah, I probably need to get a copy of this too. So, you know, you can look up things. And,
exactly.
And they just sort of become compelled to go mm-hmm. ahead and buy the book.
Yeah, but completely not necessary. I mean,
right, right.
But if you're going to, you know, say you find something at your local game store, they're running a weekly Pathfinder game. You might do well to get the core book and a basic set of dice.
Yeah,
and you're good to go.
Okay.
So I hope that was helpful. It's been a while since I've donned the robe, so
you did a wonderful job there. If I may, just as we're kind of wrapping up the session here, do you have any opinions so far on the new Star Wars Edge of the Empire RPG from Fantasy Flight?
Yeah,
that was kind of an exciting announcement at Gen Con.
Yeah, I've read the book. It's interesting because it's a lot. The big trend in RPGs is now going to a more kind of rules light and story driven idea, kind of like the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, where you roll dice. It tells you like how many successes you got, and then
it's like reading tea leaves.
Exactly, it is exactly like that. And you know, you kind of interpret, you know, based on what you get. It's like, oh, I got 3 successes, a failure, and a danger. You know, what does that give me? And you know, if you have a group that's good at that, it's very good. If you have a group that's bad at that, that's very kind of, you know, is that left or right brained?
I don't know.
Brained, where, you know, you're very numbers inclined, then, you know, you might have like, I don't care how I feel. Did it hit me or not? You know,
right.
Sort of I think it's good. They're doing a beginner. I know they're coming out with like a beginner box-esque thing.
Yeah.
Because I think Paizo, it's pretty much Wizards of the Coast came out. They tried to recreate the red box for 4th edition. It didn't do that well. Paizo came out with the beginner box and it just killed. I mean, it was heralded as a great thing. Even outside the gaming community, people were talking about how good it was. So I think Fantasy Flight, it looks like they're doing the same thing. They're coming out with the beginner box for the Star Wars Edge of the Empire thing. I think it'll be good. It's still kind of too early to tell. It's still in beta, but
yeah,
you know, we'll see.
I would like to play that if you ever wanted to run it.
Yeah, I'd consider giving it a shot.
All right. Well, with that, we thank Chancellor Jones for another wonderful edition of the GM Academy, and hope that answered your questions, Trent. And with that, we consider class dismissed.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Buy, Try, or Deny, where this time Cody and John will be reviewing one of the greatest games of all time, Monopoly. This Milton Bradley classic.
Wait, not Monopoly. Trent wants us to review Android Netrunner.
Well, who the hell is Android Netrunner?
No, it's not a who. It's a game. It's the new card game from Fantasy Flight came out at Gen Con. That's what Trent wants us to review.
How much did Trent pay to win this auction?
Well, he paid enough. We're gonna do Android Netrunner.
Look, right now I got $10. I got a quarter. $10.25. We can do Monopoly.
No, we're not gonna do Monopoly. Listen, stick to the script. We're doing Android Netrunner.
Trent, I hope that you appreciate what I'm doing for you. And now, Buy, Try, or Deny with Android Netrunner.
Netboy, Netgirl, send your signal round the world. Let your fingers walk and talk and set you free. Netboy, Netgirl, send your
it is time for Buy, Try, or Deny, and by Trent's command, we are...
Yes, my lord.
Yes, my lord. We are doing his favorite game, he mentioned. His favorite game, Android Netrunner, which now, is a...
Whoa. No, I was going to say, I wonder if that's his favorite game or if the original Netrunner.
Well, he specifically put Android Netrunner.
Okay, all
right. So by rule, I feel like I'm Ed Hockley. By rule, it is the new edition.
Oh, there's some fine
first down Colts.
Fine biceps you got there.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. And so, as you mentioned, you know, this was a riff on an old mid-90s CCG, Netrunner, back when it was cool to say the net. I'm surfing the web.
Cyberspace.
I remember, because this is the only part I get to speak in this.
you can speak whenever you'd like.
No, I'm fine. When I first watched the movie The Net. With like Sandra Bullock, circa 95-ish.
Yes.
And in the opening scene, it was supposed to be, you know, set a few years in the future, I think, you know, when the internet was supposed to permeate our lives like it has. And she orders a pizza online.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, I'm like, That will never happen.
Dude, I did the exact same thing. I saw the movie in the theater, and I'm like, that's crazy. Yeah. Can you imagine actually doing that?
What godless existence is that? You don't have to call the pizza company. You know, and, you know.
I haven't ordered a pizza with a phone in probably 2 years.
Well, there was when EverQuest 2 came out, I was in college, or I just gotten out of college.
Uh-huh.
They had the slash pizza thing. You could be, there's some partnership with Pizza Hut or Domino's or some such pizza company. You could type in game, so you're sitting there, you're playing your dwarf, whatever. You could type in slash pizza, and it would open up something where you could order a pizza.
Wow.
So, pizza and internet aside, talk to us about Netrunner, John.
All right. So, Netrunner was originally designed in 1996 by one Richard Garfield, who you may know from other games such as, Magic the Gathering, or more recently, King of Tokyo. He's kind of gotten real notoriety from that game. Also, designer of the board game Robo Rally. So he's had a little bit of success.
All right.
He's done okay.
I'm still hoping he gets some residuals off Magic.
Yeah, I hope that Magic thing works out for him, but yeah, he's okay. Anyway, he designed Netrunner in 96, and when this game originally came out, and I believe it was produced by Wizards of the Coast, It was in full CCG format. It came with like a starter box and then booster packs and all that kind of stuff. And the game kind of died out after just a few years, although it had a pretty big following during the time that it was there. My speculation is that this game would have remained huge for a long time if it weren't for the particular theme that it had. And it had that sort of cyberpunk 2020, neuromancer sort of a feel there, Shadowrun, cyberpunk, that kind of a thing. But, they're talking about things like sysops, and jacking into the net and just all these terms now that are just kind of silly in our world where we are permeated with the internet and wireless communications and all that kind of stuff.
Remember America Online?
Yes. So
we got 20 free hours.
Oh, yeah. That's
good.
That was stuff. High.
That's, I'm just going to warn everyone in advance.
1440 baud mode.
Well, John is giving an excellent rundown of the game, I'm just going to throw internet nostalgia at you.
That's fine.
That's all I got.
That's hot stuff. Yeah. Anyway.
Welcome. File's done.
So, I think because of that, it ended up, I don't know, maybe this is just my opinion, just looking maybe a little bit cheesy and seeming a little bit less relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, but the gameplay itself, as you'll see, is very, very interesting. So this past year, or this year in 2012, Fantasy Flight came out with a new version of Netrunner called Android Netrunner that they have set in their Android universe. Now, Android is a board game that was designed a few years ago by Kevin Wilson.
Recently departed from Fantasy Flight Games.
Yeah, he's kind of going his own way now. Yeah,
I love you, Kev. Cheer up, buddy.
Good guy. So he designed that game, and this sort of Android universe has spawned games like Infiltration. It's also spawned a series of novels. So it's a very interesting
world. Why don't they make the RPG? Android
Cody has said that we thought that would be really a great RPG.
Printing money.
Maybe that's coming. They're doing Star Wars stuff. Probably not. So. Yeah. So they decided to re-theme Netrunner with this Android theme. And I think this was a really smart idea because the Android theme is so, it's like far future, kind of dystopian, dark future. And I don't know, it's so set apart from, sort of the real world that we live in. I think that this can be a little bit more timeless and can last for a lot longer. So anyway, they've also released it in their LCG format, which means that the game comes in sort of a starter box, a core set, for $40 retail, that's going to give you enough decks and permutations of decks to be able to play the game. You don't ever really have to buy anything else except for that starter unless you want to, the core set. But then every so few months, they'll be releasing different cycles of these sort of chapter packs. I think they're calling them something other than chapter packs, but it's got some kind of themey name to them.
Cyber packs.
Cyber packs. And, you got nothing. And that will allow you to, customize your decks more and do the deck building portion of a normal CCG. But unlike the blind booster model, the LCG model is one where you'll know ahead of time exactly what's in each of these sets so that you can build the decks as you want to. So this has worked, I think, pretty successfully with some of their other games. And we'll see how it turns out with Android Netrunner. But this was by far the hottest thing that I saw at Gen Con as far as just flying off the shelves, and they sold out within just 15 minutes. the very first day of Gen Con. They brought in a second shipment of it, and that sold out really quickly too. So what's Netrunner all about?
What's Netrunner all about?
I'm glad you asked.
You've got mail.
In this game, unlike Magic the Gathering and other CCGs, where you have this sort of balanced approach where everybody brings a deck with them and the decks are kind of the same and you're just seeing whose deck is better, you know, as you play this game. This game is solely a two-player game, and it is played asymmetrically, which means that one player will play the evil corporation. And the
misunderstood corporation. They're just trying to make some cash.
They're just trying to get a nut in this nutless world. I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know.
We're losing them.
I don't podcast anymore. And then the other player is playing the runner, who is sort of this freewheeling hacker who's trying to hack into the corporation's system to get information and to try to tear down the evil agendas of the corporation. And so because of that, the runner deck and the corporation deck look very different. They have completely different backs to them, so you can't mix these cards up. And the different card types are completely different, and the gameplay is completely different for each side. And so that this asymmetric design is a kind of a benchmark of Netrunner, and it's a very interesting aspect of the game, and I think one of the coolest parts of the game. So the idea in the game is that it's set in this dystopian future of the Android universe, and the object for both players is that they want to score 7 agenda points. And in the case of the corporation, they are setting agendas out and they're trying to advance those agendas so that they can then score them and put those agenda points in their score pile. At the same time, the runner is trying to access those agendas, and we'll talk about accessing things in a second, to access that data and to be able to steal those agendas and to be able to take those points. Then the first player to get to 7 of those points is the winner. Now, the game is divided up into different factions. There's 4 corporate factions and 4 runner factions. And the core game itself comes with starter decks for all 4 corporate factions and all 3 of the runner factions. Did I say 4 runner factions?
You did.
Three runner factions.
Liar.
Sorry.
So you got AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy, and...
That would be cool if those weren't all IP that a Fantasy Flight would have to pay for. So
I got Prodigy.
Oh, man. It's the Wayland Consortium, NBN, Jinteki, and Haas Bioroid. Those are the 4 corporations. Then your 3 runner factions are Anarch, Criminal, and Shaper. It still sounds a little cheesy, but...
A little bit. Shaper.
Shapers, yeah. And so there's a very clever way to be able to build the starter decks for this game. Each of these corporate factions and runner factions have a set of cards that go along with just that faction. Then there's a whole bunch of neutral cards that you'll, if you want to build like a criminal starter deck, you take all the neutral runner cards and all of your criminal cards, mix them together, and there you go, there's your starter deck. And there's a very interesting sort of kind of a point buy system to be able to put different runner cards into your runner deck or different corporate cards into your corporate deck that are from opposing factions. And there's just some rules as far as the number of points that you can spend on cards that are from other factions. So there's a lot of customizability as far as being able to build out your decks the way that you want to. So the way that the game is going to be set up is that the runner is pretty much going to be playing all of their cards face up on the table, while the corporation is going to play most of their cards face down. And I'm going to kind of split this explanation up real quickly into the runner section and then the corporation section, and that might be give you a good idea of how the game works. So we're going to start off with the corporation. So the corporation is trying to protect their crap. They're trying to protect their data.
They sure are.
And to protect their agendas. And so they have 3 main areas that have data that they're interested in protecting. They have what's called R&D, which is the name for their deck, like the face down deck. You have HQ, which is your hand. And then you have the archives, which is your discard pile. And these are all areas that the runner might be able to do a run on and access. And so the corporations, one of their main jobs is to try to protect those particular areas. And in addition to that, they also have things called remote servers, where they can sort of set up additional areas that might have important information, like agendas and things like that, that they're trying to advance. Keep in mind, you're trying to advance agendas, which will get you points. That's the main way to do it. But at the same time, you're trying to protect what you have as the corporation so that the nasty runner won't come in and steal your stuff.
That mean old runner.
That mean old runner. And so you will have, as you, in your play area here, your R&D, your archives, and then your hand will be the HQ. And then these possible remote servers. You're also going to have what's called a credit pool. This game does use some cardboard tokens in it that represent money, basically, with space bucks or whatever. In the original game, they were called bits. In this new version, they're called credits. And so you're going to start off with 5 of those credits, and each player will start off with 5. And this is what you're going to do. You're going to spend those in order to kind of get cards onto the table. So the corporation has a whole set of actions that they get to take on their turn. They're basically a list that they get to choose from. And in addition, the corporation will always start off their turn by drawing 1 card from R&D. So you get a draw card, and then you will spend different, what they call clicks or actions, to be able to do these different actions. And the Fantasy Flight version here comes with this nice little card with a called a click tracker that will allow you to kind of keep track of your different actions. So you draw a card, and then the corporation gets 3 actions that they can choose from. And here's the different things that they can do. You can draw a card from R&D. So you've already drawn a card, but you can spend a click to draw another one. You can spend a click to gain 1 credit. You can spend 1 click to install an agenda, asset, upgrade, or a piece of ice. So these are the different kinds of cards that are in the corporation's deck. An agenda, like I said, is how you're going to get points in this game. And these are cards that you're going to be able to advance. And once they've advanced to a certain level, then you can score them. So it's almost like if you have a level 4 card, something like that, then it might require 4 advancement tokens before you can score it. So you can install that card for 1 click, which usually will involve playing it face down in front of you in one of your remote servers. This is like an area, you know, just an area in front of you that's going to, you know, be a place for information. You can have as many remote servers as you want. But then you might want to do some things to protect those servers, because if you don't have protection on your servers, if there's nothing protecting that card that's face down, then the runner can just come right in and access it and take it from you.
You gotta get McAfee or Norton.
Semantic or something.
Semantic.
Yeah. And so another kind of thing that you can install is what's called a piece of ice. Ice is the main... It's ice, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cyber, diamonds.
Cyber ice. And ice is going to be your main defensive cards in the game. And these cards are played kind of horizontally. So when someone plays a piece of ice, you always know that it's a piece of ice. Some of the other cards that you play face down, the runner may not know whether you're playing an agenda, or you might be kind of bluffing and playing some other kind of a card down. But the ice cards will always be played horizontal so that you know that they're ice. And they're going to be played right in front of whatever they're trying to protect. So let's say that you installed an agenda, which is, you know, you'll play that card face down, and you're, you know, on later turns, you're going to want to advance that so you can score points. But you want to protect it, so you put a piece of ice right in front of it. And that card is played face down as well. And so that just tells the runner that, hey, there's some protection on that card. You may not know what it is, but there's some kind of ice protecting that, some sort of defense there. In addition, you can also play ice to protect your HQ, which is your actual hand. So you can sort of set that in front of each of the corporations has an identity card. And so usually you'll set the ice in front of the identity card to indicate that you're protecting your hand, your HQ. You can put ice in front of R&D, in front of your deck. You can even put ice in front of your archives as well. So these are lots of different areas where ice, and you can have multiple pieces of ice protecting them, which sort of creates a multi-layered barrier for when the runner wants to come in and access things. It just sort of, it's layers of protection for you.
So what do you call the people who install the ice? What do they drive to work?
Ice trucks?
Icicles.
Oh, that's nice.
That's all I got.
You've got mail.
File's done.
All right. So installing cards and putting them down in front of you, that's going to cost you a click. But in general, you don't have to pay any credits to be able to play a card down for the corporation. That's in most cases. You can play an operation, and this is the exception. It costs a click to play an operation card. An operation, if you want to use Magic the Gathering terms, it's kind of like an instant. It's a card that you can play on your turn. You'll pay a particular number of credits to play it, and then you can do whatever it says to do. And these might be cards that give you credits, or they might allow you to do any number of things. I mean, they, like most CCGs, this game is really governed by what's on the card. So you'll just basically play the operation and do what it says. you can also spend a click and also spend a credit to advance a card. So I mentioned that these agenda cards need to be advanced before they can be scored. And so you can take a credit and spend a click and then take a credit and advance a card by putting the advancement token on top of it. It's kind of neat because the credits look like money on one side of them, on this of the token. When you turn it over, it turns into this sort of a glowing sphere, glowing circle, and that's what you are considered advancement tokens. And then you'll just lay that credit right on top of your card that you're advancing. So you're laying this on top of usually a face-down card for your agendas. But keep in mind that the corporation has the option to install a card that's not an agenda. They can install some kind of an upgrade card or an asset or some other kind of card that's not an agenda.
Trickery.
And some of those cards can be advanced so that it might make your runner think that that's an agenda that's being advanced and might be a good bluff, good bait to make them go after it. Maybe it's a trap of some kind that will cause them damage. This is my favorite part of Android Netrunner, is the fact that there's such a bluffing aspect to the game, that the corporation is playing these cards face down and is trying to misdirect the runner so you can catch them in a trap or cause them to do things that are detrimental to them. So that's a really, really fun part of the game. You can also spend an action. You can actually spend three actions to purge virus counters. There's different cards that the runner might play that will cause virus counters to be put on you. You can purge all of those counters for three actions. And then you can also do something called trashing a resource on a tagged runner. So if you spend one click and then spend two of your credits, you can basically cause harm to a runner who has been tagged. And there's an aspect in the game where you can, where a runner might get tagged. A tag sort of represents, the corporation has information on the runner. It's found out that runner's address or some piece of, or their name or some piece of information about them. That's kind of how it would fit in the theme of the game. And if a runner is tagged, then that allows the corporation to have some power over them and can actually trash one of their resource cards, one of the things that will help them out. So getting tagged is a bad thing for the runner, can be a really good thing for the corporation. So those are the different actions that you can do is to play any of these cards out. All the things that I've described there is sort of how the corporation sets up their game in sort of a defensive strategy. They're trying to protect their agendas and then get those agendas advanced at some point. So that's let's move on to then what the runner is able to do, and then we'll be able to kind of play out how a game turn works. Now, the runner has a completely different set of cards that go along with what they have, and also a different set of terminology for what their cards and their deck are called. So the deck for the runner is called the stack. You got that, Cody? The stack.
Yeah, I got it.
Their hand is called the grip.
Okay.
And the discard pile is called the heap. And then the cards that are played out in front of you in your play area is called the runner's rig. And so these are going to be like hardware cards and resource cards and program cards that sort of make up all of the offensive capabilities that the runner has to be able to attack the evil corporation. So the runner has a series of actions as well that they're able to do with the intent of being able to make a run on the corporation to be able to access their files. So the runner actions are, the runner has a different thing in that they don't get to draw a card automatically. But they do get four actions, and one of those actions they can spend a click to draw a card. So you always have that option. So literally, you can do these things. I don't think I mentioned this with the corporation. You can do these actions as many times as you want. So if the runner wanted to spend all four of their actions just drawing cards into their hand, they could totally do that. But these are the different actions. You can spend a click to draw a card from your stack. You can spend a click to gain a credit. You can spend a click to install a program, a piece of hardware, or a resource. All of the runner's cards are played face up. And so these are just things that are going to build up your rig, your resources. Resources for a runner might be a job, like they're hacking into the system at night, but during the day they got to have a job so they can make some money. So it might be a card that represents a daytime job that they have, and maybe that card will have 12 credits on it, and every turn you can take a credit. So it's pretty much getting paid. And so I like that. That's kind of a nice themey thing. So other different kinds of resources that you could have that will help to improve your situation, get you money and things like that. Your rig will also include hardware, which are going to be different pieces of, kind of computer hardware that you're building in that are going to allow you to do certain things. They might even also give you things called links. I think I mentioned earlier that the corporation may try to put a trace on you that might cause you to be tagged. The links will allow you to kind of combat those traces. I'm not going to go too detailed into traces because that's a little more complicated part of the game, but it's just another way that the corporation can sort of attack the runner, and the runner has to have some defenses against that. And then programs are going to be the main way that a runner is going to be able to combat this ice, the defenses that the corporation has put in. And so having specific kinds of programs will allow you to combat certain kinds of ice. So installing those cards is going to cost a click and action. And I'll just say click from now on. Click and action mean the same thing. They're going to cost you a click. And then those cards might also cost you some credits to be able to play on the table. So you have to spend that cost as well. You can spend a click to play an event card. This is kind of similar to the operation cards for the corporation, where just things that, that'll happen, and you'll play the card and do what it says. You can spend a click and two credits to remove a tag. You can get tagged multiple times, and the more tags that you have, the worse things can happen to you, or the longer that bad things can happen to you. And so the runner is going to want to try to get rid of those tags as quickly as possible. So one click and two credits will remove a tag. Those tags are represented by cardboard tokens. You can't have a Fantasy Flight game without a big pile of cardboard tokens.
That's how they make their money.
Exactly.
About stock and a cardboard.
And a cardboard plant. And then the final thing that the runner can do is the most important part of the game, and it's the main mechanic in the game, and that's make a run. And so that's the whole thing. That's why it's called Netrunner. Is the runner is going to try to access information in the corporation. I'm just going to go real quickly through a run, and then I think that'll kind of give you an idea overall of how the game works, and then we can sort of discuss a little bit more. But the way that a run happens is that the runner is going to choose one of the locations in the corporation's play area, either archives, R&D, HQ, or one of the remote servers where they may have set down some cards, and is going to say, I'm going to make a run on that location. And so you can sort of think about it as the runner approaching, running up or whatever, sending their program out or whatever, to confront this particular location and whatever might be in front of it. So, and in many cases, there's going to be one or more pieces of ice. So the pieces of ice may be face down or face up. If they're face down, then they say that they're unrezzed. This is another one that's nice. kind of cheesy terms.
Yeah.
You got to rez the card, right?
Sure.
So if it's unrez, that means it's face down. When the runner approaches that card, they'll basically say, I'm approaching this card. And then the corporation has to decide whether they want to rez the card and turn it over so you can see it, or whether it wants to just say, I'll pass, and you can run right by it. If he chooses to rez the card, or de-rez the card, rez the card, de-rez the card, turn the card over. The terminology is kind of vague, but then you
maybe you can ask on your news group.
Yeah, exactly. My BBS.
Yeah.
Then you would the corporation would have to pay the cost in credits to be able to rez the card and turn it over, and then at that point, then the runner will have to deal with the ice. And so let's say that would happen. You turn over the card and you have to deal with the ice. Well, that ice is going to be a particular kind of defensive program, and is going to have things on it called subroutines that are written on the card. And in order for the runner to be able to get past that piece of ice, they're going to have to break each of those subroutines. If they're not able to break all of the subroutines, then whatever the subroutine does to the runner will happen. And so that's where these programs come into play, because certain programs will be able to counter certain kinds of ice. And so if you have that, then it might be able to cancel subroutines or delete subroutines. Now, the subroutines themselves may not actually end the run. It's not going to necessarily stop them cold, but it may cause bad things to happen to them. It may cause them to take some damage. In this game, for the runner, damage is usually in the form of discarding cards from your hand. So they have things called meat damage and net damage.
Veggie damage.
Meat damage and net damage, which will just cause you to discard a particular number of cards based upon the amount of damage. There's also brain damage, which is more severe because not only do you have to discard the card, you are reducing your overall hand size. And that's a bad thing. Once those subroutines, you have to either decide whether you're able to break those subroutines as a runner or whether those subroutines will affect you. And then when you go to the next piece of ice, if it doesn't end the run, then the runner gets the choice to basically either continue on or they can jack out, which will, you know, they basically can end the run themselves. And so sometimes there's some benefit to initiating a run, even if you know you're not going to get to the end of it, like if you're going to get stopped by the ice, because it might force the corporation to turn over that ice card. So now you get to see what it is. So right. Now you can design your attack to meet that particular
piece of ice.
You're
testing the defenses.
Exactly, yeah. And once if you're able to get through all the pieces of ice, then you will get to access that particular location. If you access a remote server, then you get to basically take the card that's in the remote server and take a look at it. If it's an agenda, you can score it, and that's how you get points in the game, is by scoring agendas. If it's another kind of card, then you have to look at the bottom of the card and see if there's a trash can symbol on there. If there's a trash can symbol with a number, you can spend that many credits to trash the card and delete it, or not delete it, I'm using those computer
terms. Put it in the recycle bin.
You can send it to the archives. You can basically discard the card. Otherwise, it just kind of goes back where it was. The same thing happens for like your R&D. If you access the R&D, which is the corporation's deck, you get to pick the top card off the deck and look at it. If it's an agenda, you get to score it. If it's a card with a trash cost, you can trash it. Or you just have to put it back on top there. So this game is about scoring points. The runs are about scoring points. They're about trashing cards, but they're also just about getting information. Because if you're not able to trash or score points, you're at least able to see what's, you know, something that the corporation has. So gaining information is a really important part in this game as well. So that is sort of how more or less how the run works. There's a lot of other little intricacies to the game, and I've talked far too long on it. But this is sort of the basics for how this game works. Now, the game is going to end when one player has come up with 7 points, but there's also some specific ways that the players can win without getting those 7 points. If the runner ever has to discard more cards than they have in their hand, then they are what was called flatlined, and they are out of the game. So if I had one card in my hand and then a piece of ice dealt me 2 meat damage, which would cause me to discard 2 cards, I can't discard 2 cards, I lose the game.
And that happened to me when we played. It sneaks up on you.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I believe that if the corporation draws out their entire deck, then that is also a win. That's a win condition for the runner.
Okay.
I believe that's the different ways that you can win and lose in the game. So, as you can see from my very disjointed description, there's a lot going on in this game, and the asynchronous and asymmetrical part of this makes it very, very interesting. And so, that's pretty much how the game is played. There's a lot of variety in the different kinds of corporations and different kinds of runners. And just I think it's just a wonderful game. And just so much depth to it and so much more than the average CCG that's just build up a big, you know, evil deck and beat up your opponent with it. There's just a lot more thinking going on in this. So with all of that, I'll stop talking for a bit and just ask Cody to describe to our listeners our buy, try, or deny rating system and how we talk about games here.
So we have a rating system that is called, cleverly, buy, try, or deny. If a game is a buy, that means you should run out and buy it immediately. It is that good. It should be in almost every collection. If the game's a try, it doesn't mean it's necessarily good or bad, but you should give it a try for yourself and see if it's something you want to add to your collection. If it's a deny, it is the Roman taxi of games and you just got to stay away from it. It should never be played by anyone, ever.
Hear, hear. So why don't we go ahead and start off with buy points for Android Netrunner.
Mm-hmm.
We've had an opportunity to play this just a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I think I played it a lot more than you have, but what are your impressions of this one?
Buy points, it's very well produced. It's a Fantasy Flight baby, so you expect that. I really like that I like the Android IP. I like that they're still doing stuff with it. I kind of wonder if they're ever going to release a second edition of Android. I know it had, some people didn't like it. It had some kind of rough edges that could be kind of smoothed out. But I think it does a really good job of using that IP. And another buy point for me is that it feels very balanced. I think it's easier to balance in a game like Magic, where you have, just like John said, two people building a deck and running at each other. This, I think it's harder to balance, where you have this very asymmetrical sort of play. You have two people that are playing two almost totally different games. They're have two different strategies, and from the games I've played, I've been really impressed by that balance. So it looks good, and it plays good, at least in the balance department for me.
Mm-hmm. I'll agree that the production is very, very good. Like most Fantasy Flight productions, the cards and the cardboard chits are really good. I had an opportunity to play the original Netrunner a few times before this game came out. I actually sought out an older copy of the starter set just so I could make some comparisons. And I would say that I really like the artwork a whole lot better on this version than I did than the original version. Although I think the artwork was lauded pretty heavily from the original version. I just didn't like it very much. I love the art from this one. I also like that the original CCG, there were no tokens in the game. So you had to pretty much come to the table with glass beads or pennies or whatever it was, mm-hmm. to keep track of the advancement counters and the credits and all of the different tags and that kind of stuff. You know, in true Fantasy of Life fashion, they have specialized tokens for all of these things now. And, you know, so they provide those with the game, and that makes it really, really easy to keep track of money and advancement tokens and all that kind of stuff. So top-notch production. The thing that I love about it is I love that it seems like it's sort of the thinking person's CCG. And I know that sounds kind of arrogant, because I know that things like Magic, those are for thinking people as well. I mean, you got to think a lot to do those kind of things. But I just sort of feel like in Magic, if someone hands me a world championship deck, you know, here's the deck that, you know, so-and-so won the world championship with, go play with it, that even if I'm not a very good Magic player, I could do well with that deck. Because the cards they just do what you needed to do. You know?
I'd say it depends on the deck.
Well, okay, there are more complex decks that require you to understand what's going on.
But I mean, that's a big thing with Magic, you know, the net decking, as it's called. You know, you just find the most powerful deck, legal deck online, and copy it.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And I think you can really do that. And I think even if you don't know much about deck building or about Magic, you can build some cards with giant creatures in them and everything and make sure you got enough mana. And, you know, you can do pretty well. Whereas I feel like in this game, you really have to play the cards, you know, and you have to know when to bluff and when to res a card and when not to. And you have, I think, just much more interesting decisions in this game than you do in Magic. I love the idea of when I play the corporation and someone approaches a piece of ice, and I've got the money to de-res it if I want to, or res it, whatever it is, turn it over. But, you know, do I do that, or do I just let them get past, you know, and knowing when to make those decisions is much more interesting in this game than it is in any other CCG that I've played.
There's a lot of layers going on.
Yeah, so that's my favorite part about it, and so that's why I would say really of all the CCGs I've ever played in my life, this is my favorite.
Wow.
So that's a buy point for me.
Yeah.
Try points, middle of the road points for you.
Two try points.
Okay.
The first is it's an LCG.
Okay.
So that could be good or bad for you. The idea that, you know, it's, if you end up liking it, it's a path to retail enlightenment sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your starter set, you have, you know, then if you like that, they have, you know, they have packs readily available for you. And that could be good or bad. I mean, I generally like the LCG model because, you know, I don't like blind purchases. I think that's a good thing. But for some, it's, you know, if you've not really played any LCGs or anything like that, and you're used to a complete game experience in a box. I mean, this has a complete experience, but it could get old rather quickly if you play it a lot. Mm-hmm. So that's a word of warning there you might want to try. The other try point is that it's a CCG. It's like, even though it is asymmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
I keep wanting to say asynchronous. I'm playing too many iOS games. The fact that it's asymmetric is that it still has a lot of CCG elements into it, where, you know, it's still, if you can find a good combo, It's still about maximizing your deck, which some people really like, but then some people are really turned off by it. So yeah. It's not one of those where it's not as easy to just pick up and play or play out of the box as some games. So two tri points, it's an LCG and it's a CCG. So be wary.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, I'm just, to clarify, I'm coming at this from the angle of I'm not someone who goes down and plays Friday Night Magic in a lot of tournaments. So, I mean, you know, and my review of this is really based upon that core set because I don't plan. I like it enough that I might buy some of the upgrades, but I'm not much of a deck building guy, you know, as far as like Magic style deck building. And so I was really pleased with how much replayability you got just from the starter decks in this game. And the little deck building rules that they have to be able to kind of add cards from other factions, I think can make it interesting just with the cards that come with the starter. You know, the LCG, the CCG element to it, if that's not your thing, that's not really going to ever be your thing, I think.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the nice thing about the LCG model is that you can buy the core set and get your money's worth and multiple plays out of it with just that. And you don't have to buy anything else, especially if you're not going to go and do the tournament scene. I think that this game is, because it's a little bit thinky and bluffy and that kind of stuff, that might turn some people off. I really like that part of the game, but I think that if you do want just a straightforward head-to-head smash 'em dash 'em game, this is not really that kind of a game. It's really much more of a bluffing game if than anything else, and trying to, you know, misdirect your opponent. The asynchronous part might asymmetric part might make it difficult for you to do deck building if you like that, because from what I've heard, when you do tournaments and stuff for this, is that you bring one of each deck and that you will play two or three games or something like that, where you'll play one side with your opponent and then you'll play the other side.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly how it's scored or whatever, but you know, it causes you to have to do two kinds of deck building. You have to figure out how to build the corporation deck and build the runner deck, and they're two very different things too. So
a noble defense.
Yeah, but I think it's that might make it a little bit additionally complex if you're into the deck building part of it. Deny points?
Couple things. Box is too dang big for what you get. The insert is terrible. I mean, it's standard kind of Fantasy Flight insert, but I mean, when you, like, the first time you open the box and you show me what was in it, it was comical. I mean, you've downsized it, this little 600 card baseball card box.
Yeah, I have it in this little tiny box.
I know it's Fantasy Flight, but come on. And then the only other deny point is meat damage.
You just don't like the concept of meat damage?
Just the word meat damage.
Okay.
That's like, oh, my steak's gone bad. I just took some meat damage.
the barbecue expansion.
Exactly.
Well, Cody is right that this game comes with about 250 cards. And, you know, those cards plus the cardboard tokens, I have them in this little tiny box. I mean, it's really just a fraction of the size of the giant board game size box that it came in. It does have a pretty meaty rule book. That's actually, I think, a buy point for me. The rule book is written very well, written far better than I'm sure my verbal explanation of the game was. But it's it really good, got a good index to it, and has good turn structure and things like that, the timing of things. I don't really have any deny points for this game. I think they did a great job bringing back what was kind of a classic game. Like I said, I really feel like Netrunner could have taken off with more staying power than it did if it hadn't been so linked to this sort of, you know, fledgling internet idea that slowly, I think, became kind of cheesy looking. Whereas I think now it's gotten some new life. It looks a little bit more sci-fi. And I think that it, you know, will hopefully be around for a long time. So I'm definitely wishing it's a success and they'll continue with it, because I'd like to keep playing this for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big CCG guy or LCG guy. I think the my favorite of the LCGs has actually been the Lord of the Rings one, oddly enough. But I thought this was good. I really like that it's not just, you know, everyone builds their best kind of samey deck and you go at it. You know, I like the thought and the story that's put into it. So if you like that sort of thing and you've liked what you've heard so far, I think you're really going to like it, because it is well produced. But I could see it being very polarizing. You know, if it's not your sort of thing, it's really not going to be your sort of thing. But if you might like it, I think you really will like it. So.
Right.
Android Netrunner. Trent, I hope you like it. You obviously do. It's your favorite game.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely like it too. I guess it's time for us to log out, right? Before the sysop gets us with his meat damage.
Well, we only have 20 hours this month, so.
That's right.
Goodbye.
Well, that wraps up this special one-time-only episode of Game On with Cody and John, benefiting the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund. We want to thank Trent Hamm for sponsoring our show and making this possible. We also want to thank Tom Vassell and for for having the Jack Vassell Fund and for putting this up on his feed. And who else do we want to talk about?
Well, if you'd like more information on the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund, or you'd like to donate, you can go to jackvassell.org. Because no one can spell Vassell right on the internet. That's V-A-S-E-L.
There you go.
I mean, I see people in his guild get the name wrong. I'm like, come on, guys. But it's a great fund. You can read what they've done. They've in just a short time of existence, they've really done a lot of good work. So check them out at jackvassell.org. And that, like John said, thanks again to Trent for the great contribution that got our butts out of the podcast retirement home.
Yeah, and this was fun,
It was good to be back in the saddle again.
Dust off the microphones a little bit. Now we get to put them back in the vault and go back to our rooms and eat our pudding cups in our podcaster retirement home. And
it is time for Matlock.
Well, I love some Matlock. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so thanks for listening, and we really appreciate it as always. And hey, until next time, whenever that might be.
Game on.
Thanks for listening to this special episode of Game On with Cody and John. Who knows when you might hear from Cody and John again. But until that blessed day, Game On!
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to...
Oh, good.
Had to get it
a little rusty.
Got to get it out of the way.
A little rusty.